out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with John Schmidt, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, about the Federal Reserve getting involved in the European crisis over there. Did they do the right thing? Personally, if you're going to be the superpower of the world, and I know my righty friends, and I know my Ron Paulians are not going to be happy, but if you're going to be the power of the world, you've got to be willing to step in when crisis pokes its head up and willing to answer the call. And if we're willing to send our military all over the world, we should be willing to step in and save the economy from collapsing yet again. But here's my problem. We should be looking at how we regulate this stuff. How do we bring this stuff down so the future isn't a continuation of this crisis after crisis after crisis? So it'll be interesting to talk to him. Also, Terry Steigel going to be here, from executive director from the Center for Civil Justice, about what's going on in Michigan with their quote unquote welfare reform, which is nothing more than kicking people off the rolls and stealing from people. And again, you know, I don't know how that's going to help our economy. It's going to take money out of the economy. It's going to cost more jobs. But there's part of me that honestly believes that's the goal. The goal is to stagnate. The goal is to make things worse so that the 2012 elections, well, they can point their fingers at Democrats and go, ah, they're the reason. And to be honest, some small level, they are part of the problem. But right now, it's the Republicans. Even my Tea Party dentist. Firmly behind the idea that the Republicans are doing nothing but obstructing and hoping things get worse so that for their own political gain. That's what's going on. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with John Rodkiewicz about the wine and spirit shops. Again, day two of the big hearings down in Philadelphia as Mike Terzai and the rest of the Republicans, you know, their will, sell off our assets, even though Jack Wagner, the auditor general, said we're going to actually lose money on this deal. And it's a dumb idea. And I think I've been saying for the longest time it's a dumb idea. But, you know, it's the ideology. It's, hey, we got to sell off everything. Let's hock it off to the lowest bidder, because that's what you're going to get. We're in the middle of, we're in the middle of a recession. And they want to sell off our assets. Now is the worst time to sell off any asset. Look, if we were in the middle of a boom economy, if this were the back in, during the Clinton years when things were booming and housing prices were going up and every price was going up and you could sell it off at a premium, I might be able to possibly come up with a justification for hocking it off, because you're going to make it, you could make a ton of money. But not now. Now is the worst time to sell. You know, it's like, well, it's the worst time to sell. In the third hour, David Dyden from FireDogLake.com going to be here talking about Martha Coakley going after the big banksters, and it's about time. It's about time somebody looks at these big banksters and holds them accountable. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. I'm hoping Martha can redeem herself. You go back to 2010, that election, and you look at the Cain campaign. Makes the Coakley campaign look good. It was still a bad run campaign. So anyway, I got an email with a with a cartoon in it that caught my attention and said, hey, I thought you might like this. Keep an eye. You know, what do you think? And the cartoon is from High and Lois. And it says, the first part of it was, the governor's stupid new tax means I got to pay an extra 35 cents on a six-pack. And the guy sitting next to him says, well, you know, we have to keep the homeless shelters open and the soup kitchens open and have health care for the poor and all of these things. Yeah, yeah. But why do I have to suffer? And I'm going, you know, this is, one, not a Republican state that would have risen a 35-cent tax on a six-pack of beer to pay for anything having to do with helping people. I would think they would give it a 35-cent rebate to get more people drinking to keep their mind off how badly they're getting screwed. But, you know, that's the mentality. You know, we go to church on Sunday. We talk about our moral fiber. We talk about, you know, how we care about each our brothers and our sisters and our neighbors. Well, we talk about that until it's time to, you know, help. Until it's time to say, you know what, the soup kitchen needs some resources. We need some tax dollars to help pay for that, or the homeless shelter, or women, or help for women, infants, and children. We all love babies. Gotta love the babies. And I've got an uncle, a fairly wealthy uncle, just loves babies. His whole life is, you know, babies, until it comes to paying for them. We love them when they're in the womb, evidently, especially the extreme right. But as soon as they pop out and have to, you know, start eating and wearing diapers and doing those things and be educated and need health care, well, we seem to kind of walk away from it then. And it's this cartoon, and I appreciate it being sent, really highlights that fact to me. That, yeah, we want homeless shelters open, and we want to make sure that children eat and that they get educated and that they've got health care and they get vaccines when they need it and, you know, all those things. But who's going to pay for it? And then we begrudge the people who need the help, and it's pretty interesting to me how we've gotten to this point. And, you know, I remember going back to the years, you know, when I was a kid, and my mother. And thank God they were there, but my mother needed some help, you know, putting food on the table. And the help was there. And I guess I just don't remember that mentality of begrudging you of something. Or maybe it was just the world we lived in. But now I seem to see people being very angry and very mean-spirited. Not the Christian mentality that we were told. That's been thrown in our face, especially during this primary. Really very, very interesting. So tonight on the program, we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of new things. Booze, of course. We're going to talk about her man. Evidently, her man's going back to his wife looking, maybe, do I keep running? Do I get out? What? Interesting to talk about him. Michelle Bachman's got a big announcement. Can't wait to talk. There's a lot of Michelle today. You know I love me some Michelle. But more importantly, there's Frank Luntz, the genius of the Republican Party, got some new words for us. And it's amazing how just a few words being changed around, how they're able, and the Republicans are masterful at this, how they are able to really just change the message completely, and how they're able to, you know, to manipulate the words so we think that they care about us. I mean, you look at that sham that went on yesterday in the House of Representatives. The Republicans, really, do you really buy that the Republican Party cares about workers? Really? Does anybody buy that? I mean, honestly and truthfully, I get that they care about the business owners. And had they just come out and say, we don't care about workers. Oh, we care about the business owners. That's who we care about. I think I would have given them a little more credit. But given, you know, the messaging that they've got out there, it's pretty remarkable to me. So again, tonight on the program, we're talking about Booz, Herman, Michelle, and so much more. Also going to take your calls later on. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Stick around right back after this.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A massive public worker strike in the United Kingdom Wednesday was about resistance to attacks on the economic and social advances made by working people in the UK over the last 65 years. Protecting pensions was the main issue in the day of action. Lynn McCluskey heads Unite, the UK's largest labor union.
Our members throughout the public service sector are infuriated by the fact that the government have launched this ideological attack on their work, their pensions, their jobs, but also within the private sector itself. The users of public services are angry that everything that has held our nations together for the past 65 years is under threat, and that's why we have to stand up and be counted.
In Olympia, state police have arrested at least 15 people who are occupying Washington's state capitol to protest some $2 billion in budget cuts. Protesters want the state budget balanced without cuts to social services, health care, and schools. Unions have joined with community groups for protest rallies against the austerity cuts that will hurt working and poor people. Andrea Bauer is with a community group called Sisters Organized for Solidarity.
In the daytime, there'll be rallies and protests every day called by different groups and unions, and on Saturday a big mass rally called primarily by the unions. But we will keep going back and we will keep attempting to stay, and we have a protest campaign going to call the governor. So we are not giving up. It's way too important to give up.
American Crystal sugar workers remain locked out, and the company's CEO isn't doing much to win over his employees. Jesse Russell reports.
American Crystal Sugar President and CEO Dave Berg was recorded at a shareholders meeting comparing the employee contract to a cancerous tumor that had to be removed. The website Workday Minnesota has posted the audio.
Can't let the labor contract make us sick forever and ever and ever. We have to treat the disease, and that's what we're doing here.
1,300 employees have been locked out since August 1st in Minnesota and North Dakota. There has been little movement in reaching a new contract agreement. Berg explained to the shareholders that the lockout was part of a long-term strategy that would be expensive in the present, but profitable for the shareholders in the future. He went on to specifically apply the tumor analogy to workers seeking to keep health care benefits in their contract.
Keep the health benefit, give them a 2% wage increase, and don't change anything else. I know that because I negotiated the last two contracts. At some point, that tumor's got to come out.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So Dennis Kucinich, a guy I got to tell you I like, he has proposed a piece of legislation, the National Emergency Employment Defense Act. The goal is to, you know, do what the Paulians want to do, replace the Federal Reserve and put it under the control of the U.S. Treasury. Good idea, bad idea. I'm in favor of it, but we'll talk about it more in the coming days. I've got John Schmidt on the line, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net is the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
You know, I look at what happened yesterday. The U.S. Federal Reserve, the big banks in the U.K., the Swiss banks, Japanese, Canadian, European banks all came together and came up with an idea to how to save the Eurozone. Curious what your thoughts are.
Well, I think it's not quite an idea to save the Eurozone so much as to buy the Eurozone a few more days, a few more weeks. If you look at what the proposal does, it basically makes it easier for banks in Europe to borrow money on the short term, particularly to borrow money in U.S. dollars and then distribute it and make it available to banks in the countries that are in a crunch at the moment. It actually doesn't do anything to address the underlying problem, which is the large amount of debt that is coming up that several countries have to refinance next year, and that they're going to have to be refinancing it at rates that are way above what they anticipated, and they simply can't afford to do that at the current rates, or if they continue to grow as they have. So it doesn't actually deal with that underlying problem. It just makes it a little bit easier in the short term.
It just saves us from the brink right now. But just, and I guess as some are saying, it doesn't really even kick the can that far down the road.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest concern. I mean, to me, it was a very important decision that happened yesterday in a symbolic sense, in that it basically said the rest of the central banks in the world are looking over the shoulder of the European Central Bank, which is a very, very difficult institution and has made some pretty horrific decisions over the last few years, and they're really putting the entire world's economy on the brink. And I think this decision kind of nudged the European Central Bank into realizing that, look, the whole world is watching, and other central banks realize that your decisions, European Central Bank, are going to affect us. And they're basically kind of stepping in a little bit, and they're saying, we're going to do what needs to happen, at least take these small steps for now. And hopefully it'll put the European Central Bank on notice that they have to take into consideration not just what's going on in their own country, but the impact that they're going to have on the rest of the world.
Now, is the argument for us getting into this, you know, if they go down, we all go down with them? Because, you know, you hear two different arguments. One saying that the U.S. Federal Reserve should go in and just take over and take care of it. And the other is that we should stay out of it. In fact, the people who want to break up the Federal Reserve, and part of me says we should be taking it back as a matter of under our Treasury. I'm curious where you stand.
Well, I mean, I do think that we are presented with a whole bunch of less than ideal options right now. The situation has gotten so bad. We've walked so far down a road that none of us particularly feel comfortable with that at this point we don't have a lot of good choices. But I do think what we need to consider is that if Europe were to have a meltdown at this point, that it would have a very significant negative impact on the U.S. One thing that it would do is whatever banks that we have here that are exposed to the European sovereign debt would take a big hit. But I think that's only part of the issue. The other issue is it's going to have a big impact on world trade. If Europe goes into a recession, the entire world is going to likely follow, and the United States is going to be part of that. So here we are moving along at a very, very anemic growth rate. And it's very hard to distinguish between where we are now and a regular recession. And I think, you know, if something were to go seriously wrong in Europe, more wrong than has happened so far, which is very likely, that would almost for sure drag the United States into a recession next year, which I think would be a disaster. And I think that's why the Fed needs to act if necessary to prevent that from happening.
Was the move bold enough, do you think?
What they did yesterday was not bold enough at all. What they would need to do is something along the lines of what my colleagues, Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot, have been calling for, which is for the Fed to go in directly and buy the bonds of countries that are currently on the brink. And I think it's one of those things which is very unpalatable, but it is the kind of thing that could actually get us past the crisis. And like some of the interventions that we saw before, they actually could end up being a profit-making opportunity for the Fed, just because they would be stepping in, providing some confidence. And since confidence is what is in short supply as much as anything else, they could end up actually doing well on their investments. But the key issue is we have to worry about what's going to happen to workers in the United States. And
right.
If the Fed doesn't act, we're going to go to, you know, back to 10, probably 12% unemployment, rather than, you know, back to 5%, which is where we want to be, and we're not in any way headed there right now.
Because, you know, I was just reading an article a couple minutes ago. Reuters had an article on manufacturing across the globe and how it's contracting throughout Europe and most of Asia, where you're seeing really just a horrible situation where we're the manufacturing capacity of the globe is shrinking because they can't get loans and people don't have money to buy the products. So we've really got a demand problem, I think.
Yeah, that is exactly the issue. I think we have a huge demand problem. Parts of the world economy were starting to look a little bit better last year. Obviously, we haven't really felt it very much in the United States. Sure, the unemployment rate's gone from 10 down to around 9%. But it's really hard to feel us in much of a recovery. But there were parts of the world where the recovery was starting to take place, even a little bit more in Europe than in the United States. And now it seems like we're potentially going to be losing all of that ground, and it could look very bad for workers here.
Yeah, I mean, even China, according to the story, even China saw their factories and their manufacturing shrinking for the first time in, I think they said, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, the situation in China is highly dependent on the world trade situation. So if the world economy takes a serious nosedive, that's going to affect everybody, including them.
So I'm looking at this, and you're talking about the Fed going in and possibly buying all this stuff up. And I know, you know, myself personally and a lot of my Tea Party listeners, you know, they're thinking about us taking on this liability and the Fed taking more over. And there's the other part of the people who are going, this is that one world order, one bank order. But as the leader of the world, aren't we kind of putting ourselves in that position to have to?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of issues here. One is that the Fed probably doesn't actually have to do this. The Fed probably just has to come very, very close to doing it, threaten to do it, say they're going to do it, put everything in place so that they can do it. And I think that the European Central Bank, which is an incredibly anti-worker operation and really is doing its absolute best to create another Great Depression in Europe at the moment. I think they're not going to be moved by the threat of high unemployment, but they will be threatened by to move if they feel that they might lose some of their power or influence in Europe. And if the Fed came in and basically said, you know, we're calling this fight, you're you know, we're sending you to the locker room, and we're going to do the rest of it, then I think that the European Central Bank would probably step in and do what we're hoping that the Fed would do, which is to step in and make sure that the debt that those countries have is going to be financed at a reasonable rate.
Yeah, and a big part of it, in my thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, as the reserve currency of the world, the dollar, we need to figure out how to stabilize it and make sure that I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I'm not fond of it being the reserve currency, but it is what it is at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the perspective of workers in the United States, probably the single most important thing we could have happen, and one of the things that could most help to improve our economic growth and restore full employment in the next in the short and medium term would be to see a decline in the value of the dollar. If we had a cheaper dollar, what that would mean is it would be much easier for us to export our goods in world markets. And when we looked at foreign produced goods, they would seem more expensive to us because the value of the dollar would have gone down. And that, excuse me, would help us, I think, enormously. It's probably the single most important thing we can do. I'm not suggesting that overnight we want the value of the dollar to crash, but I think an orderly decline in the dollar over a period of time is actually a very pro-worker, very helpful kind of thing in terms of restoring full employment.
Well, look what it's done for the Chinese.
Exactly. It's a very good example.
I mean, you look at all of the job losses over the last 10 years. I think I've seen somewhere around 2.4 million jobs lost because of our trade deficit with the Chinese. And at the end of the day, we can complain and carry on about our budget deficits here in the nation. But to me, much worse is our trade deficit.
Right. I mean, I think if you keep in mind, there's a lot of people who are out there calling for the Chinese to revalue their currency, to raise the value of their currency. And that is exactly the same thing as saying that we are calling for the United States to have a decline in its value, the value of its currency with respect to China.
Well, who would not want to see it go down? What's the negative impact of devaluing the currency?
Well, I mean, I think the stated concern is usually that it will lead to inflation. Right now, we have an extremely low level of inflation and no prospect of that happening anytime soon. But I think the other issue is I think particularly the financial sector, Wall Street, really likes to have a strong value of the dollar. It's the kind of thing that allows them the maximum flexibility and the maximum capacity to buy, for example, assets of foreign countries in U.S. dollar terms. There's a whole lot of reasons I think that it works for them. But it works strongly against the interests of the typical U.S. worker. I mean, if the value of the dollar fell enormously, that would be a problem. But if it fell to a value that brought it about an increase in U.S. competitiveness without significant decline in bargaining and buying power, I think it would be a big step forward for U.S. workers.
Interesting. Last question I've got for you, John Schmidt. You know, in looking forward, looking down the road, this has happened. What should we be paying attention to in the coming days, weeks, and months?
Well, it will be very interesting to see if the Europeans can organize some sort of rescue on their own terms of the governments that are currently in financial straits. And the key issue is, will they try to take actions that will avert another Great Depression, a recession over there? And right now, I'm pretty pessimistic, but I just have to hope that they're playing a game of chicken, and at the last minute, they're going to curve back and do the right thing. But only time is going to tell.
Yeah, I look at what's going on over there with all the austerity measures, and it seems to me almost like that they want a collapse. I mean, much like we're doing here, all of the cutting, taking money out of the economy, and then surprise, we're losing jobs. They seem to be shocked by that.
Yep.
John Schmidt, a senior economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net. Again, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. John Schmidt, I appreciate the time. Thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
In response to the Supreme Court's freakish decision in 2010 to bestow political personhood on corporations, I got an email from a guy named Larry screaming that big money has plucked our eagle. Yes, it has. And the powers that be tell us that we shouldn't even try to undo this theft of our people's democratic authority, but instead should just try regulating corporate money, like maybe requiring them to disclose how much they're spending on campaigns. Now there's a bold stand for democracy. Give us campaign finance reporting regulations or give us death. Come on, we're bigger than that. Here are just a few actions for real change that you can take, teaming up with others right where you live. Amend. Two major coalitions are organizing to overturn the court's corporate money edict by amending the Constitution. One is freespeechforpeople.org, and the other is movetoamend.org. And both have action kits for raising the issue locally, petitions to be circulated, video and other good graphics to educate people, and a wealth of other organizing ideas. Localize. Pass your own local and state laws to stop the wholesale corporate purchase of our government. These include outlawing any corporate claim of personhood in your area, providing the alternative of public financing for your local and state elections, and banning campaign donations by corporations that try to get government contracts and subsidies. For information and help, check out publiccampaign.org and reclaimdemocracy.org. Confront. Yes, get in the face of power. Ask all candidates where they stand on corporate personhood and demand that top executives of big corporations located in your area publicly agree not to spend corporate cash on your elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, the Constitution plainly says we the people, not we the corporations.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
We found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it'll probably fail. But our machines don't leave no paper trail.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Well, it's become painfully apparent to even the most casual observers that Republicans don't want you to vote. They don't believe in the voting process. You look at the other day, Rick Perry didn't even know the voting age. People 21, that's their goal. They want those. They'd love to see it go back up to 21. I'll bet my bottom dollar. But the Democrats have finally come around to the realization that Republicans have been just beating us up. Trying to take away our right to vote. Now they've come out with their own website, protectingthevote.com. And there's a couple little interesting tidbits on there that they've come up with. Because during the Bush administration, they claim, they launched this multi-year investigation. Because we've got to find voting fraud. Got to find the fraudulators. Got to know where the fraudulent makers are. Got to find them. We're going to look for them. We're going to find them. So what they during this multi-year investigation, what they came up with, they came up with a possible number of voter impersonations, voter fraud, real true voter fraud. They came up with 9 cases during that entire span. Now, during that span, they also came across 352 people who were struck by lightning and killed, and there were 32,299 UFO sightings. So I don't know about you, but you know, in a country of 300 million, and you can only find 9 instances of any problem, is that really worth destroying your entire system? And, well, to the Republicans, yes, because the only way that they can win is by suppressing the vote. And they've been very upfront and very open about that. Paul Weyrich, the guy who was a co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, you know, years ago, you know, telling a whole bunch of pastors and ministers back in 1980 in Dallas, saying, you know, we don't want good government. We don't want people voting. He said, you know, look, our power goes up as the voting populace goes down. Which is why throughout the Bush years, you saw caging, you saw all kind of legislation to try and, my favorite, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the 80-pound paper rule. They went out and they got a whole bunch of people to sign up to register the vote. And he said, sorry, they're all invalid because we're going to use this 1820 law or 1840 law that mandates you use 80-weight paper. Well, granted, they took it to court and they got it thrown out, but they tried. And you look at what's going on with this voter ID nonsense. It's to do one thing. Because I just told you, 9 during the entire span when the Bush administration was looking for voter fraud. 9 out of how many millions of votes cast? How many tens of millions of votes cast? 9. That's all they could find. Well, I think the guy who's the Speaker of the House in New Hampshire, I think he's hit it pretty clear. A guy named William O'Brien, Tea Party guy, he was telling this Tea Party crowd recently that his view on it is, you know, we don't want to have same-day registration. We don't want college kids voting because these kids come out, and this is his quote, the kids come out of the schools and basically do what I do when I was a kid, which is vote as a liberal. That's what kids do. They don't have life experiences, and they just vote their feelings. Yeah, like the feeling of hunger, like the feeling of, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to pay for my college education because the tuition rates keep going up and the federal government keeps shrinking the amount of help that I'm getting. Yeah, I got that, right? So what they're doing across the country, not just New Hampshire, across the country, there are states who have said, you know what, no more student IDs. We want these photo ID laws, but they can only be approved. No student IDs. And there are some states even, they don't even take veterans' IDs. Completely unacceptable. But in Texas, I mean, you know, look, if you're not going to take them, don't take them. But in Texas, your gun license, that's perfectly okay. So a student ID, no. Students, bad. Guns, good. Wisconsin, they're going to allow student IDs. And you gotta love this. They've got some very strict qualifications on who a university is, and what lines you go on, but you can use them, but they have no university in the state that qualifies under their rules. So basically no students in Wisconsin can use their photo ID to vote with. So I look at this and I go, well, what's the end game? What's the point? Well, the point is to suppress the vote. The point is to hold people back. If we really, truly, honestly believed in the democratic process, the right to vote, we would do like we did in Iraq. We'd have paper. We'd have a little thing to put our thumb in. Hey, I voted today. Thumbs up. And you could go that day. You didn't have to register. You put your thumb on the pad. You voted. If we really believed in that whole democratic process, the right to vote, the sanctity of the ballot box. Remember how they just went on and on about the Employee Free Choice Act? I was stealing the sanctity of the secrecy and the sanctity of the ballot box. Oh, they were so concerned about your right to vote when it had to do with choosing to join a union. But choosing who runs the country, well, we want to limit those people. We want to make it much harder. We want to make it more difficult. No same-day registration. You know, we're going to make it really hard. As where I'm saying, you know what? If we truly are this democracy, everybody should be able to vote. Doesn't that make some sense on a certain level? And then maybe we don't end up with politicians who do some of the dumbest stuff. I mean, look at John Boehner, who was asked about the middle class tax break. You know, this payroll tax that they want to continue that I'm hoping they don't allow to expire. And the plan to pay for it by putting a surtax on people making over $1 million a year, which I think is reasonable. And it's a very small amount, but you're looking at about 113 million households across this country who are going to see their taxes increase if Boehner and the rest of them do not pass this through and pay for it with this very small, very reasonable, but very rational tax on people doing wildly well. It's called what's doing in the best interest of society for the good and welfare of the country. You remember that? Remember the McCain, country first? Well, here's one of those moments. Go to the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, under God, one nation. If you're gonna say the words, say them all. Just don't focus on under God, focus on one nation, under God, indivisible. All. I mean, I'm amazed at this stuff, and it just blows my mind. And he was asked about whether it would hurt the economy. He goes, well, you know, I'm not an economist, I don't know. Well, who knows? Kind of a who cares kind of scenario. Now, there are some people out there who have done some studying on this, some smart folks. And they say by letting it expire, you're going to lose about 400,000 jobs. It's going to cut our GDP by about 0.5%. So what you're going to see is you're going to see mass layoffs come January, February, March. There are other people who are saying that this Ameriprise Financial Services, they're estimating that extending the cut would add somewhere between 750 and a million jobs, 750,000 and a million jobs, because people have money in their pockets. You want to talk about uncertain? And this is, you know, I had an interesting conversation with my Tea Party dentist this morning, talking about uncertainty in business. You want to talk about uncertainty? You talk about that family who's right now struggling to put food on the table, and they're looking at Christmas going, man, I really want to get my kid a Christmas present. We really got, I want to have a nice holiday for my kids, but I got to worry about putting food on the table in January, February, and March because my taxes are going to go up. But our Republican friends, yeah, not so concerned. And maybe the idea, I mean, maybe the good idea, and this is maybe they'll follow the Newt Gingrich idea, and we'll just put those kids to work. Never mind Christmas. You know, the Scrooge, never mind Christmas. Go to work cleaning bathrooms. I don't know if you've seen this latest bit from his speech where he's talking about, well, I'm going to double down on the child labor thing. You got to put those kids to work cleaning bathrooms to learn responsibility. And then he goes into talking about a program that he started, and good for him. I think it's a great program, and I'd love to see him do it more on a larger scale than just 9 kids in a housing project. But he offered kids, you want to read a book? We'll pay you $2. Every book you read, you get $2. It's a great idea. Going to these inner city housing projects like when I was a kid, $2. So he's right. When a kid reads a book, he gets those $2. When the ice cream truck comes by, he's got some money in his pocket. I think that is great. But the idea of going, well, you know, we're going to change it from reading books and improving your life to clean the bathroom, kind of, to me, sends a mixed message. It kind of shows, what their view of work is, what their view of incentive is, but more importantly, what their view of the youth of this nation is. And I think it is just exploitable labor. If we can get them cheap, if we can get them young, if we can keep them, just on task, that much better for business. Because we've got to be business friendly, after all. And make sure that they don't get uppity and want to go do that thing called voting. Don't want that. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. This is why we fight, why we violate.
Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Like I said last night, I guess we've caught the welfare queen. The $500, that massive $500 overpayment in the SNAP fund, well, worth with prison time. Come down hard on those people. Get the bankers on Wall Street. Well, we seem to, well, we don't want to regulate those people. But around the country, we're seeing this. We got to go after those people at the bottom. We've got to go after quote-unquote reforming welfare. You look at Florida. You want to drug test every person who gets any assistance. And look at the whopping results they got there. 2% they caught. Good for them. I'd like to see them line up all of those legislatures. Let's see if they pass. Anyway, in Michigan, they're doing kind of the same thing, but some people are fighting back. That's why I've asked Terry Stengel, executive director of the Center for Civil Justice, ccj-mi.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com to come on and talk to us a little about what's going on in Michigan. Terry, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be here, Rick.
You know, as I said, you know, you look around the country and you're seeing all these attacks on people that are poor. I mean, you know, we like to label them, you know, food insecure or economically insecure, but these are poor people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are people who are struggling every day to find and keep jobs and to make ends meet. And a lot of people who were middle class are now finding themselves in that very situation. The sad thing is a lot of these folks are among the most vulnerable in terms of fighting back when they're kind of put under the microscope to see how everything is being spent. You don't see the same kind of attention to what's going on when people are getting loans and guarantees and tax breaks, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And, you know, I've always said that the reason we go after folks at the bottom is because they're easy prey. I mean, you look at recently the SEC was trying to let Citigroup off the hook with it was a sizable fine, but still not as large as what they got away with. And fortunately, a judge said no. But you know, we let them go pretty much with a slap on the wrist. But people at the bottom, man, we really beat them up to try and keep them in line.
Yeah, and the irony is it ends up costing taxpayers a lot more money to do the oversight and the enforcement and the verification when you're talking about $50 or $100 overpayment or a month than it's worth. I mean, so from a purely, you know, fiscal taxpayer perspective, And from a good government perspective, this is a really expensive and not very cost-effective strategy.
Yeah, I had wondered.
So much time and money to go after the nickel and dime kind of problems. And you're absolutely right that when the feds have gone in and audited these cases, and particularly in the area of food, the error rate is very, very small. It's only 1 or 2% of the caseload. So there's a lot of media play. But when you actually go in and audit the cases and look at it, that they really find very little errors.
And I think that's important to point out because, you know, last night we talked about the state of Pennsylvania released the evil nine. Out of all of the people in the state of Pennsylvania who are getting some type of assistance, be it the heating assistance or the SNAP assistance or any of the WIC programs, they found nine people in the state. Who they had given overpayments to, and they went after and prosecuted. And I was like, you know, how much money did that cost to prosecute those handful? I think they're much bigger fish to fry at this point. Now, I'm not saying I'm in favor of people cheating the system, but I think there's a scale there.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think it's indicative that a growing number of people. Are frustrated, and they're frustrated that they're having trouble getting a living wage and getting health care and paying their bills. And so there is this sort of media sense that somebody is getting something they don't deserve. And rather than sort of people working together to say, let's all have living wages, decent health care, good schools for our kids, there's a lot of finger-pointing about whose fault it is.
And it's always the person behind you, it seems to be, because they're the easy targets. They're the ones that you see every once in a while. And look, I mean, there's all this talk around the country, and the Republicans have done a masterful job of pounding the drum that there are these welfare queens out there, that there are the people cheating the system, and we need that's what's going to solve our problems, and it's not. But you're seeing these things that they're calling reform. Like I said, in Florida, they want to drug test people. In fact, you've got presidential candidates saying we should be testing anybody who gets unemployment or any of that stuff. It's insane to me. But
well, that's certainly been around. That has come up before the drug testing. In Michigan, a number of years ago, there was going to be a drug testing, and there was actually a lawsuit that was filed. And the court said at that point that it is unconstitutional to do across-the-board drug testing. You really need to have some kind of indicator or suspicion.
Right. But
so if you've got some kind of grounds or suspicion for doing it, then you can absolutely do the drug testing. But kind of a across-the-board, there appears to be constitutional problems.
Well, I mean, but the rationale would be you're unemployed, you're not working, you're asking for help, so you must be doing drugs because you're not pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
Well, in Michigan, where we have five people looking for a job for every job that's there, I think that's a harder argument to make. But here in Michigan, we just cut off 40,000 people, 30,000 of which are kids, many of whom are working, many of whom have disabled children, simply because over the past 15 years, they had too many months of getting any amount of cash. So you could be a mom working full-time, have four kids working a low-wage job, needing that extra $50 a month on cash to help out. And if you've got that too many months, they just cut you off, even if you've been doing everything that we ask a parent to do in terms of supporting their family. Or if you had been excused for caring for a severely disabled child, and it was less expensive for mom to stay home with that child than to pay for high-end child care or put him in foster care or a nursing home, if you did that too many months, now they've cut you off. So these folks in Michigan have no chance of getting on any kind of assistance again from the state. And it's not because they were scamming the system. They followed the rules as they were told at the time, and they just weren't able to make that break into being fully self-sufficient.
Well, it sounds to me like good, solid family values are being practiced there in the state of Michigan. The whole Christian nation thing seems to, pop into my mind when I hear that kind of stuff. We're going to throw people off this because, they went to work and they're doing the things you said. And I think family values right away.
Well, yeah, I think there is a big question about, what are we really trying to do with the system? I completely support you know, doing what we can to get people to be working and to be becoming self-sufficient because, you know, most people, they really want to.
Absolutely.
And there are certainly a few folks that are going to try to take advantage. But that's not unique to low-income people. You see that at the workplace. You see that in Congress. You see that at the corporate level where the people are trying to get stuff and you know, that they're not supposed to or to cut corners. That happens. It's not unique to the poor. But it's a very small amount because, you know, our spending in the welfare system is highly regulated. And currently, since, you know, in most states, if you are not, you know, going to a work program, if you're not complying with work requirements, they cut you off. And if you do it a couple too many times, you're cut off for life too.
Yeah.
So the landscape for welfare has changed a lot from the days when people thought you could get it and do nothing. That's not true anymore.
But
every state pretty much has pretty strong work requirements.
But that frame is still out there, and I keep hearing people telling me that all the time. Well, you know, people are on welfare for generations, and you know they never get off of it. And I go, well, isn't that what the whole thing in '96 was? Wasn't that?
Well, I think the real problem is that, you know, in the last 20 years, wages have not kept up with cost. I mean, we're blaming welfare, but it's really that our employment system is not really designed. It used to be in our parents' or grandparents' generation, you could have, you know, and frankly, you know, one parent working, maybe a stay-at-home parent, a part-time parent, and that family could have a house, a car, live a good middle-class life.
That's because we had strong labor unions.
That is true in terms of where the work is for many, many families. The manufacturing, the good jobs you could get with a high school degree or you know, just aren't there, you know, the way that they once were. So people can work one or two jobs or have both parents working, and, you know, they're still getting help with food or health care or child care because they do not make a wage that can support their family.
And
so I think that's the bigger societal problem,
right?
That we're unwilling, you know, we like our inexpensive goods, but we don't want to pay people a decent wage either. So, and this is where the rub is.
Well, the argument I've been making for years is it's come down to two things. We've allowed labor unions to be weakened, and we've pursued insane free trade agreements.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different factors on that. But when you actually talk to families, and when we talk to thousands of families that, you know, that call us with questions on the food assistance program, what we call it in Michigan, you know, a lot of those folks are working, the vast majority are working, and some of them worked their whole lives and have been laid off and are looking for help for the first time in their life. And they're scared and they're embarrassed. But, you know, they've got kids to feed and they've got those resumes out and they're doing everything they can, but, you know, have not been able to find a job.
So they're not the lazy people that we're told, all those lazy unemployed who are lounging around in luxury collecting those huge checks?
I can't
checks.
Tell you how many people I've talked to who said, look, I'm really not one of, quote, those people. I mean, they've kind of bought the myth, too, and they're frustrated that they don't seem to be able to get help and sometimes, too, because they're saying, I'm doing everything I can, I'm trying, you know, the pieces haven't come together. And, you know, I know in my own organization at one point I advertised for a part-time bookkeeper. And you know, I had hundreds and hundreds of resumes of people with a lot of bookkeeping experience from all over the state. You know, and I was looking to hire one person, and it wasn't a very high-paying job because it was part-time. And that gave me a clue of, you know, how desperate people are looking for work.
Yeah. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Terry Stengel. She's Executive Director of the Center for Civil Justice. CCJ.mi.org is the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Terry's name. It'll take you right there. Let's go to the Michigan thing for a minute. What's going on in Michigan? You said they're throwing people off the rolls. What's the justification?
Well, I mean, what the state has said is that they've argued. Well, I mean, let me back up. Back in 1996, Congress basically gave states permission to impose lifetime limits on welfare. They didn't want welfare to be a lifetime proposition. Well, you know, nobody really wants welfare to be a lifetime proposition, even the people on welfare.
Right.
And so at Michigan from 1996 to 2001 did not have any time limits, or until 2007, actually. And what Michigan said is, as long as you're doing everything we ask you to do and you're following the work rules and you're showing up when we tell you to and you're taking the jobs when we offer them, we're not going to cut you off if you're not making enough money yet to get off.
Sounds rational to me.
That was our policy for all that time. We were one of the few states in the country that had that. In 2007, that began to switch, but there were still some exemptions for people that had barriers, had disabled kids, who were working, you know, the required hours, but weren't earning enough to get off, that kind of thing. This past year, Michigan changed the law again and tightened up the exemptions. But what the agency did is they came up with their own rule that said anyone who got $1 of federal benefits back to 1996, even when we told you there were no time limits, we're going to go back and count all those months, and if you have 60 of them, you're off. Yep. So lots and lots of people who, as far as they knew, they were doing everything they were supposed to, or they were exempt, you know, they weren't violating anything, have now just been told, sorry, you're done, and you can't ever get back on, no matter what your circumstances.
Wow. But again, you know, you look at this, we're saving taxpayer dollars, though, aren't we?
Well, the irony, I mean, we're not saving state dollars, because frankly, if Michigan were to put all those people back on, they could still use, it's less than 20% of the caseload, and federal dollars can still be used to pay for it. So it doesn't have to, you know, yes, it's taxpayer dollars, but it's federal dollars.
So it sounds to me, it's just, they're just being mean.
Well, I mean, I think they're trying to save money. I think they want to spend the money somewhere else. And, you know, they're looking for who they can cut and who is least able to fight back and complain. The other thing that's going on in Michigan, you alluded to this, is a tendency to, to start judging how people spend money and add a kind of moral element of how the money is being spent. And this is kind of a new phenomenon. The question of, you know, is somebody on welfare, you know, what kind of car do they have? How long have they had it? Have they used any money they have to buy a lottery ticket or to buy certain kind of food products that we don't approve of? And I understand the impulse for that, but I find it kind of scary to have, government intruding in people's lives that way.
I'm right there with you.
If you're taking a federal dollar, because if you can do it to a welfare person saying if you get, a certain amount of dollars, we're going to, regulate how you spend your money. Are they going to do the same thing with a student loan or with a business loan or whatever else, that if somebody's getting money or a grant, that there's going to be micromanaging of certain business and household decisions?
Most certainly a slippery slope. Last question I've got for you. You know, I hear an awful lot that, well, you know, we're funding all of these illegals. So I'm questioning with the welfare system.
That's absolutely not true.
But you hear it all the time. The frame is there constantly. We're giving all this welfare and all this aid to these illegals. And I just wanted you to say that what you said.
Yeah, it's absolutely not true. I mean, it's one of those kind of things that people say it enough they think it's true. Now, you do see households where there are citizen U.S.-born children who may be getting food assistance or getting Medicaid for themselves. But certainly the household members that are here illegal in most states are absolutely not eligible for assistance. There are a few minor exceptions in the Medicaid program, for example. In an emergency in a hospital, the hospital may be able to have to get some payment for that. But that's one of the few instances.
But there's no line of undocumented people with their hand out collecting all these wonderful benefits, like I keep getting emails almost daily on.
No, that's certainly not true in Michigan. And the amount of documentation that people are required to turn in to get benefits, for themselves, would exclude people that don't have proper citizenship or green card documentation.
All right.
So, I think that's one of those things that people, because it's been talked about so much, assume it's true. They haven't done the research to check. They haven't talked to people who actually run the programs or know, because in most states that's simply not the case. For most programs. And sometimes it's a federal prohibition that it can't be done.
All righty. Terry Stengel, I appreciate the time. Great talking to you. Executive Director for the Center for Civil Justice. We've got a link to their website at therickmithshow.com. Thanks so much.
Okay. You're welcome.
All righty. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A massive public worker strike in the United Kingdom Wednesday was about resistance to attacks on the economic and social advances made by working people in the UK over the last 65 years. Protecting pensions was the main issue in the day of action. Lynn McCluskey heads Unite, the UK's largest labor union.
Our members throughout the public service sector are infuriated by the fact that the government have launched this ideological attack on their work, their pensions, their jobs, but also within the private sector itself. The users of public services are angry that everything that has held our nations together for the past 65 years is under threat, and that's why we have to stand up and be counted.
In Olympia, state police have arrested at least 15 people who are occupying Washington's state capitol to protest some $2 billion in budget cuts. Protesters want the state budget balanced without cuts to social services, health care, and schools. Unions have joined with community groups for protest rallies against the austerity cuts that will hurt working and poor people. Andrea Bauer is with a community group called Sisters Organized for Solidarity.
In the daytime, there'll be rallies and protests every day called by different groups and unions, and on Saturday a big mass rally called primarily by the unions. But we will keep going back and we will keep attempting to stay, and we have a protest campaign going to call the governor. So we are not giving up. It's way too important to give up.
American Crystal sugar workers remain locked out, and the company's CEO isn't doing much to win over his employees. Jesse Russell reports.
American Crystal Sugar president and CEO Dave Berg was recorded at a shareholders meeting comparing the employee contract to a cancerous tumor that had to be removed. The website Workday Minnesota has posted the audio.
Can't let the labor contract make us sick forever and ever and ever. We have to treat the disease, and that's what we're doing here.
1,300 employees have been locked out since August 1st in Minnesota and North Dakota. There has been little movement in reaching a new contract agreement. Berg explained to the shareholders that the lockout was part of a long-term strategy that would be expensive in the present, but profitable for the shareholders in the future. He went on to specifically apply the tumor analogy to workers seeking to keep health care benefits in their contracts.
Keep the health benefit, give them 2% wage increase, and don't change anything else. I know that because I negotiated the last two contracts. At some point, that tumor's got to come out.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Or check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And yeah, if you were to watch that that dog and pony show yesterday, I don't know how Republicans could possibly look the American worker in the face and say, yeah, we're on your side, after that whole charade yesterday. And of course, I'm talking about the Workforce and Democracy Fairness Act. You gotta love that. Such nice language. It passed 235 to 188. Six Democrats voted for it. Eight Republicans, decent, conscious Republicans, voted against it. And the folks over at Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist's group, of course, the most powerful man here in Pennsylvania, who I don't even know if he knows where it is on the map, him and the Alliance for Worker Freedom, they were very happy that the Congress stood in support of the Workforce and Democracy and Fairness Act. They called it yet another pro-growth jobs bill, somehow stealing the rights of workers. Yeah, that's pro-growth. Anyway, I've got Carla Walter on the line. She is a senior policy analyst at the American Worker Project at American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Carla, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
Another pro-growth jobs bill. That's how they described this Workforce and Democracy and Fairness Act.
Yeah, I mean, this is just another case of scapegoating. It's the same thing we saw in Ohio and Wisconsin. You know, blame public sector workers instead of tax cuts and just an untenable tax base as far for the budget problems. Now we're seeing House Republicans blame the NLRB instead of their failed economic policies and, you know, Wall Street for our current economic problems. And so instead of going after, you know, these real problems with our economy, they're trying to cut funding to the National Labor Relations Board. They're trying to block enforcement, and they're even willing to shut down government, shut down the National Labor Relations Board in order to move this policy forward. You know, yesterday we saw a small win for workers' rights in that the National Labor Relations Board actually did vote to advance a policy to standardize union elections. But this is just one small battle in what the GOP is lodging as a war on workers' rights.
Right, just one small step back in the direction that we were pre-George W. Bush, because if you look
sure.
at all of the attacks that happened during the W. years, I remember, you know, just screaming during those years that we were losing rights at an alarming rate, yet, you know, our Republican friends, they weren't sticking up for the workers they claim to love so much today back then. So yesterday we talked to someone from the Machinist Union out in Seattle, Washington, and, you know, the big, and I find it very ironic that on the day the Republicans push forth this euphemistically named Workforce and Democracy and Fairness Act, that Boeing and the IAM come to an agreement and negotiate as kind of what the NLRB is supposed to help facilitate, negotiating, come to an agreement on your problems. I find it very interesting that on the same day those two things happen.
Sure. You know, the NLRB is supposed to provide a legal framework for which, you know, when employers and workers have a problem, they can go to the NLRB, but hopefully these problems should be resolved between the two of them. And that's what we saw happen, is that actually, you know, workers had to go to the NLRB because something very bad happened, but when that happened, you know, they both were able to then come to the table and say, how do we negotiate a deal that will work for both of us?
Right. You know, I look at this, and again, you know, you love this. Grover Norquist and his group said, yet another pro-growth jobs bill, and I hear the Republicans spewing this. We've passed 25, 60, 80, 3,000 jobs bills, yet you look at them, they're not really jobs bills. I mean, this, I don't know how in your right mind you can look at this and say, somehow that is a pro-growth jobs bill. I'm just not getting it.
No, it doesn't create a single job. All these attacks, you know, you can catalog all these attacks on the NLRB, you know, attack after attack after attack, and none of them create a single job. And, you know, all workers should actually care about this. It's not just the NLRB doesn't just protect the rights of unionized workers. It also protects the rights of non-union workers to talk with their coworkers about wages and work conditions and safety issues and to bring those concerns to management. And we're seeing that the National Labor Relations Board is actually quite active in protecting the rights of non-union workers, too. But Republicans don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, but it's protecting the rights of workers. That's what it was supposed to be. It wasn't protecting the rights of the employer. It was protecting the rights of workers.
And encourage collective bargaining.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm watching this thing, and I was fixated on it most of the afternoon. And I saw the guy who's a congressman in this listening area, Todd Platts, who I'm hoping at some point they get rid of him. But he was saying, you know, gee, you know, the way things are going, employers just don't have the time to talk to their employees. They just don't have the time. And I'm going, isn't that what happened the day you hired them? And every day they came to work for years and years and years, didn't you have an opportunity to treat them well and pay them well and give them the respect and dignity that they're now trying to fight to get?
No, well, yeah, and this is all about delaying the process for union elections. And what we see is that employers actually start talking to their workers about their opinions on unions the day they get hired. And when a union election, when workers are starting to talk about unionizing, employers find out right away.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, nearly 50% of the serious unfair labor practices that are filed in union elections happen before workers even are able to organize enough to get a petition to say they want to unionize. So employers know about this right away, and they start organizing right away. You know, the rule that House Republicans are attacking would simply standardize the process and take out a few of the barriers to unionization, speed up the process. I don't even want to say speed up the process. Make the process a bit more efficient. There are still so many barriers facing workers, and this is just one simple, common sense way to make it a little bit easier for workers to get a fair shot at unionizing.
Yeah, but why would those workers want to unionize? Things are so wonderful right now. I mean, you know, I was listening to one of the Democrats speaking. I think it was Maxine Waters who brought up a statistic that I've used 100 times since it came out. The top 1% from 79 to 2007 saw a 275% increase in their after-tax income, as were the people in the middle class saw a 40% increase. You could factor in inflation and a whole bunch of other things. Basically, what's going on is people in the middle class and below, they've flatlined. There's no increase in their wages. And the reason I think you want to unionize is level that out a little bit.
Oh, sure. And when unions are strong, the middle class is strong. And I'm not just talking about the unionized middle class. All of the middle class is stronger. And what we've seen is, you know, 30 years ago, when we had much higher unionization rates, much higher percentage of wealth went to the middle class, or of income went to the middle class. And as those unionization rates have fallen year after year, so has the percentage of income going to the middle class. So today, and this translates to real dollars, if unionization rates were 10 percentage points higher, which is roughly the rates they were in 1980, workers would see nearly $1,500 more per year on average going to middle-class families, whether they're unionized or not.
And what would that mean for our economy?
Well, I don't have the exact dollar figure in front of me, but that would be a great boost to our economy. You know, middle-class families, when they receive more income in their pocketbook, they're going to go out and spend it. They're going to, you know, put their kid in braces. They're going to go down to the Target and buy what they need. When the wealthy are increasingly receiving more and more of the income that our country generates, well, they save it. So, you know, it's not just good for middle-class families. It's good for everybody.
Or the top 1% creates jobs in places like China and India.
Yeah.
But you're talking about redistribution of wealth, Carla. That's not the American way. We don't redistribute wealth in America.
I think what we're talking about is we've got a population that is ever more productive. Americans have gotten more productive year after year after year, and we're saying, you know, we should get rewarded for that productivity, those productivity increases. It's not about redistributing. It's about making sure that the right income goes to the people who actually generated it.
Yeah, I heard that come out of one of the Republicans' mouths yesterday. America's about, you know, it's about working hard and producing and being rewarded for your productivity. And yet I've got a bunch of graphs that show that productivity is going through the roof. It's wages that have stopped. And the reason being, pretty simple in my estimation, Ronald Reagan. At that point, things seem to go the other way. And the only thing I can come up with, and, you know, I'm just a truck driver by trade, but that's when really they put the pedal to the metal on destroying unions in this country.
Yeah. And, you know, the economic benefits, people always talk about, oh, these economic benefits go to the unionized. And they go to industries where there's a lot of unionized workers. But there's also these democratic benefits that help strengthen the middle class. You know, when there's more unionization, when unionization rates are higher, more people get out and vote because unions get on the phone and call people and tell them, you got to get out to vote. So, you know, looking at the last presidential election, if we had 10 percentage points more unionization in our country, we would have seen 3 million more people get out to vote. And they also promote policies like minimum wage, like fair tax policy, like Wall Street reform that makes a real difference to middle-class families.
And all those CEO pays and all those bonuses that even the Republicans yesterday taking a page out of Frank Luntz's book and saying, oh, we don't like that the CEOs are taking so much. We wouldn't have to complain about it. We would have something there to kind of balance that out because, you know, you look at these big companies, if the CEO is going to take $50 million for himself, when he has to sit across the table from the representative to negotiate the contract, somebody's going to go, well, you took $50 million. What about us?
Exactly.
Makes sense to me. So where should we be going with this? Last question before we move along. Where should, if we had a functional democracy, where would this thing be going?
Well, I think we would be seeing all of the reforms that we're seeing the 99%ers out in the street talking about. We would be seeing, you know, Wall Street reform. We'd be seeing more affordable colleges. We would be seeing more unionization, and we'd be seeing workers getting a fair shot at unionization. You know, all these things that are common sense things that people are now screaming about, I think would hopefully become a reality.
I'm right there with you. But do we not like the job creators? Because I heard that all day yesterday, that we're beating up on the job creators.
You know, Boeing's a job creator, and they were able to eventually get some sense and come to the table and negotiate something with their workers. This is about workers being able to sit down, you know.
Excellent point.
With their employers.
Excellent point. Carla Walter, I appreciate the time. Senior Policy Analyst at the American Worker Project at American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. Carla, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great night. Let's take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In response to the Supreme Court's freakish decision in 2010 to bestow political personhood on corporations, I got an email from a guy named Larry screaming that big money has plucked our eagle. Yes, it has. And the powers that be tell us that we shouldn't even try to undo this theft of our people's democratic authority, but instead should just try regulating corporate money, like maybe requiring them to disclose how much they're spending on campaigns. Now there's a bold stand for democracy. Give us campaign finance reporting regulations or give us death. Come on, we're bigger than that. Here are just a few actions for real change that you can take, teaming up with others right where you live. Amend. Two major coalitions are organizing to overturn the court's corporate money edict by amending the Constitution. One is freespeechforpeople.org, and the other is movetoamend.org. And both have action kits for raising the issue locally, petitions to be circulated, video and other good graphics to educate people, and a wealth of other organizing ideas. Localize. Pass your own local and state laws to stop the wholesale corporate purchase of our government. These include outlawing any corporate claim of personhood in your area, providing the alternative of public financing for your local and state elections, and banning campaign donations by corporations that try to get government contracts and subsidies. For information and help, check out publiccampaign.org and reclaimdemocracy.org. Confront. Yes, get in the face of power. Ask all candidates where they stand on corporate personhood and demand that top executives of big corporations located in your area publicly agree not to spend corporate cash on your elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, the Constitution plainly says we the people, not we the corporations.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender anyone at all. Just got time to say your prayer.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So today, back in 1955, this was the day that Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus, fueling the growing civil rights movement at the time to win desegregation in the Deep South against the Jim Crow laws. The thing that most people don't know about it is Rosa Parks had gone to the Highlander Folk School, a school in Tennessee that labor and civil rights leaders had put together to teach everyday folks like Rosa Parks how to engage in direct action, workers' rights, civil rights. It's important to understand those education components. It's important to understand that educational process. So, again, today, back in 1955. Let's go to the phones. I got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Yeah, and God forbid we ever teach labor history in the schools, and then the kids might understand what the hell's going on around here.
Heaven forbid. Heaven forbid they know something.
Yeah, you know, God forbid they ever, learn about A. Philip Randolph or, the civil rights movement or why it is that we have an outfit called OSHA or why you have an eight-hour work day or et cetera, on down the line. You know, they think that the government created all these things just to look out for us. They don't realize it. People like my great uncle got his head busted open to get.
Wisdom said that the Super Bowl was going to be the Eagles and the Jets.
The Eagles?
Yeah, oh yeah, that was the preseason. Yeah, it was going to be Eagles and the Jets. Oh no! Oh, I so lied to you. I so lied to you. No, the continuing hagiography of Timmy Tebow is going to get even worse this week.
Oh, what is it? Who is it?
It's the Vikings.
Oh, no. So that's another good opportunity, huh, for him?
Oh, yeah. He'll be kneeling and praying and speaking in tongues. And...
Oh, and I heard today, because, unfortunately I was driving my car and I had Mike and Mike on. That show drives me crazy. But they were talking about he was given a pep talk before the game.
Oh, did he make the promise again? You know, because they damn near, well, they cast that in bronze at the University of Florida after Ole Miss whooped them. No, here's the rest of the Broncos schedule. So it's the Vikings. That's going to be awful.
Yeah.
Then they are at home with the Bears. Who will probably be, breathing, spewing blood, just trying to breathe that time of year. Then they're at home to the Patriots.
Oh shit! Well, that's one I might have to try to lock in and watch that one.
And then they finish out on the road at the Bills, and home with the Chiefs.
Oh, come on!
They're only. Sandra, they're only a game back of the Raiders.
Oh, God, the Patriots is really the only huge, huge challenge, isn't it?
But both the Bears and the Patriots come to Mile High, and, Denver gets to give 3 points just on the oxygen content.
Well, no, I mean, I've watched games with the Patriots and the Broncos in the past where they beat the Patriots fairly regularly. It's not, it's not unheard of. So, God. Anyway, I just am sort of mortified by the whole spectacle.
But well, only because it's disgusting.
it's just really bothersome. But it's funny how, I see the basketball, they're trying to get themselves together. The thing about them is that people want a shorter season, so if they're only playing 60 games, it's like, yay. They might want to consider doing that permanently.
That makes sense to me. 60 games is plenty, especially when you consider the length of the playoffs.
Oh, and the only other sports thing that I was laughing at, because another talk person that I hate desperately is that Colin Cowherd. Have you heard of him?
Oh, he's loathsome. He's disgusting.
God, he's hideous. Anyway, he interviewed Tiger Woods today.
No.
Right. And I, you know, I haven't had a chance. I was thinking about tracking it down to see what it was. But what I'm thinking is, my, how the mighty have fallen. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, when you're doing interviews with third tier ESPN radio guys,
and
when
Apple,
you can't even get Dan. Yeah, well, when you're doing interviews with ESPN radio's resident racist.
Yeah, he's horrible.
Because this is the same guy that just rode Chad Ochocinco like a borrowed mule for weeks on end. Well, you just wait. I remember driving down the road here and thinking, you know, God damn, this is not radio. This is just slander.
Yeah, no,
you just wait. He won't have a pot to piss in a year after he's out of the league, spending all that money on all that bling.
And then that's when Ochocinco came out and tweeted something about, you know, I had your girlfriend. It's something real crazy. It was hilarious. I wish I remember what he said, but he clowned that Cowherd's ass. He's disgusting. He's like the worst. I can't stand that guy. He's just some sort of right wing, always talking about the producer. He's one of them types.
Yeah, and see, as compared, he may. Jim Rome is Edward R. Murrow compared to Colin Cowherd.
Please, compared to that. Are you kidding me? Not only that, but I can even tolerate, you know, Mike and Mike compared to the,
yeah.
You know, but he has to be the worst. And I was just laughing because I'm thinking about poor old Tiger. It's like, Tiger, my, you're slim. You understand what I'm saying? What happened? What the hell's going on? You know?
Got them caddy problems and...
No, and then the slimness and all. Yeah, so his shit is real weak. I don't know what's going on with old Tiger, but I said, no, don't talk to that.
Yeah, you know, things get weird when you go off the human growth hormone.
Yeah, and you know, it's
you're not
like,
so bow-legged anymore, and you get your neck back, and, you know, your face stops looking like you're 14 years old.
You're not so puffed up anymore, and more importantly, how do you putt? Can't swing, can't putt. Your short game sucks. What happened? You go on calling Cowherd. It's like, anyway, listen.
Yeah, well, you know, you it's not like he could do it. He had to do Colin Cowherd. It's not like Celebrity Jeopardy was open.
Oh my God! But anyway, shouldn't even comment because I haven't even heard the interview. I just the thought of it just sort of had me nauseated because you know that guy just he really drives me up the wall. So.
I know. There are just some that out there that do it to you, Sandra. We get in late from these Dr. Bill Prism American History chats.
Mm-hmm.
So we roll in the door, you know, it's 11:15, something like that. And you can't just say, okay, good night, everybody, because you're still, you know, that's my...
wind down.
Yeah, that's my 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, my that's too late for a nighty night beer or anything like that. So, you know, on goes the electric TV box, and I'm casting around, and there's effing Ed Schultz. You know, God, I love GQ burned him to the ground. I don't know if you saw this, but they listed.
Oh, I heard a bit about it.
Yeah, they listed Ed Schultz as the third least influential human being on the planet.
Didn't they say nobody watches it? I mean, because
it's like, come on. The only reason you're watching it is because you're on the Stairmaster and that you can't get anybody to come turn the channel.
Oh my God, no! And he is so. That has to be one of the most thin-skinned assholes out there. That Ed Schultz, he's terrible.
So, so there's that. But so no, not gonna stay there. You know, so make the obligatory sweep down to Channel 9, hoping there's some sort of rerun on PBS. But no, F me running. It's Charlie Rose or Tavis Smiley or something. And I'm just afraid they're going to hypnotize me and make me go out and do terrible things. So I got to go. And so I go across CNN, and I have never watched it before, Sandra. But like a slow-moving train wreck, I actually gave like 20 minutes of my life to Aaron Burnett.
Oh, see, no, that's you need an ice pick for the eye for that shit. She is horrific. Are you kidding?
And I don't mean just because she's a right-wing horse's rear end.
No, she's just terrible anyway.
She is bad at what she does.
That's what I'm saying. No, I mean, That's what I mean.
I mean, I clown around behind the microphone about not being able to pronounce things and stuff. But if you give me $1 million,
right,
and you put me in front of the TV camera, I'm going to be trying to figure out how to pronounce people's names.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm
just little basic things. In the space of less than probably 90 seconds, she screwed up two basic names that you don't screw up if you're even remotely paying attention. You only screw these names up if you're a Fox viewer who knows less about what's going on than people who don't even watch the news. And one of them, she had the South Carolina member of the House on, and she didn't just do it once, she did it twice, maybe three times. She referred to him as Representative Clyburn. The guy's name's Clyburn. But she emphasized that O-R, Clyburn. I'm like, honey, this guy's high up in the Democratic minority hierarchy in the House. His name's Clyburn. You've got interns there who know his name is Clyburn. You've got one of those much maligned teleprompters in front of you that can give it to you phonetically, and not 90 seconds later they segue from the story, some story about it was about the super committee and about the already burgeoning attempts to defeat the triggers, okay. And she transitions out of that to the story, the Syracuse story, where she starts repeatedly referring to Syracuse head basketball coach Jim Boeheim.
Oh, no! Oh, shut up.
And, you know, I try not to be one of those guys who criticizes somebody's spelling on the Internet, because, you know, when you're down to saying, oh, I can outspell you, you know, you're pretty much picking over the bones at that point. But this is for-profit media, 1% broadcasting, multi-millionaire in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And it's a big story, and you can't even be bothered to look up. Oh, look, it's Boeheim. You know what? She doesn't have any problem saying Boehner.
No.
But he's Boeheim.
No, she's hideous. She's awful. You know? Amazing.
And it's just astonishing, or at least to me, Sandra, because I don't spend that much time with it. It is simply astonishing to me to see how badly degraded the 1% for-profit media have become. They're not even trying anymore.
Yeah, no, it's just terrible programming, and it's just terrible information. But by the way, do you know if the Roots had to apologize, or was it the network that apologized to Bachman? You know that story.
Yeah. I think it was the Roots themselves.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
God.
You know, we poked fun at people, and we certainly didn't mean to hurt anybody.
Oh, shit. I said, oh, no. Anyway, because they're like a fabulous group.
Yeah, they are.
I saw them in person years ago in San Francisco. But anyway, I just thought that was damn funny. I mean, how many days did it take Bitch to realize what was going on? That was the most funny.
Jesus. she was studying up on back when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor, Sandra.
Or praying away to whoever, right?
Right, and declaring that teaching evolution is teaching the only viable theory of biological diversity, that's government censorship.
Oh, listen, and one more thing. Where is Mr. Obama? Is he at some summit? Is he back in town? I mean, I ain't seen him in days.
He's been a traveling man. Oh, he's made a lot of stops. No, I don't know if he's home yet or not.
Anyway, he better try to get some FaceTime.
Here in a minute, after we close out our conversation, I've got some audio to run from, Morning Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Joe apparently had a scream fest at Mika today.
Oh, that poor bitch. She's still on there?
Yeah. Screamed at her over Obama.
Listen, when is that That Clinton chick, she got some sort of broadcasting job, too. Where's the qualifications for that?
You know, whatever the qualifications were that got Luke Russer the job.
He's an idiot. Good Lord.
There's no meritocracy in the for-profit 1% media anymore.
No, I see. But I was like Clinton. I mean, I know she's over-edumacated, but really?
I still love that word. I just love that word.
I know. Okay, have a good evening.
On the local level, it's basically an unfunded mandate. One local legislator we're kind of working on right now has six of these little 2-3 car police forces in his district. The state's already cutting their funding, and he wants to give them more work to do. How crazy is that?
It's insane. But what do you tell people? Because, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people who they're all in favor of it. They think it's a wonderful idea because we're consumers, and consumers should have choice. But I don't think they're thinking about the negative social consequences, of all of this.
They're not only thinking of the negative social context. There's nothing in this bill for the consumer. It's not really a free market bill. It's based on a gallonage tax that will put up the things most people drink most of the time, the average people, the 99%, I'll use that. What they drink will be going way up in price. The gallonage tax taxes by volume rather than the value of the product. And like somebody else said, it's like taxing a car by weight instead of by value. Now, the 1% is great. Hey, my little Jag that I'm buying for my wife for Christmas is going to be taxed less than
that box of wine.
86-year-old family van over there that the working guy has to drive. I mean, again, how crazy is that? The box of wine, there's different estimates depending on what you put for the markup. You got to remember, Terzai's bill has two levels of markup, wholesale and retail. We just have our 30%. The one I have happened to be in front of me here has like the out of the 50 top-selling wines in PA, 31 will increase, 19 will decrease. But the ones like the Franzia Sunset Blush box wine goes for like $13 now, up to almost $25.
Well,
you'll be paying the guy buying a bottle of Dom Perignon, to something we all know, will be only paying 17% of the tax that your average Joe is paying on that box of wine.
Oh, come on.
I mean, this isn't made for the consumer.
John, that can't be that. I mean, it can't be that blatant.
It's simple arithmetic.
I mean, we in the working class can't be getting screwed even on this. Come on.
Mm-hmm. Nope. The Terzai tax, right now, the Johnstown flood tax, as they call it, I like to just call it the liquor tax. That's what it is. On that box of wine is $2.24. Under the gallonage tax, $10.90. Almost the whole price you're paying now will be that tax.
Well, maybe that's how we'll keep
consumption.
Huh? It is unbelievable.
And it would be getting, you know, as far as the selection they think they're going to see, maybe in Philly, maybe in Pittsburgh. But as far as new products coming in, and I don't want to get too much into insider baseball stuff.
Right.
If anybody does, I'll say it right now. There's a great study out there, Google PLCB Users Group, the Honest Privatization Index. It's not a PLCB site. It's actually a site maintained by a man who favors privatization, but just sees that this bill is just total baloney. And he breaks it down with the fees they would be paying on potential new items that might not even sell. None of these wholesalers they're setting up are going to take that risk.
Yeah, and I don't see mom and pops putting up $1 million or $1.2 million or whatever it is that Terzai thinks he's going to get out of it. I just don't see mom and pop putting that up.
No, I think a lot of the Commonwealth Foundation's testimony from yesterday, excuse me, where they were talking about taking away the limits on the number of licenses by an owner.
Right.
I mean, that just benefits the big boxes. Yeah. Mom and pop will be beat to death with Sam's Club. I mean, you can forget that.
Yeah, but when you're talking about the Commonwealth Foundation, you might as well just say the Tea Party think tank.
Oh yeah, they had a great study similar to what I was just reading you on the taxes, but when they came up with the new prices with Terzai tax, first of all they used all higher and mid-level items. They didn't mention box wines, but they left out any retail or wholesale markup. They included our 30% markup, but no mark. I think they thought nonprofits were going to bid on all these licenses, and you can find that on the web. That was one of the most outrageous lies I've ever seen in print. But, you know, sometimes that stuff blows by people.
Yeah.
They want to see what they want to see.
See, this is one of those issues where either you're in favor of it or you're not, or you just say, you know what, I would like it to be right there where I can get a hold of it. So what do you tell people who, you know, maybe be on the fence, maybe they slightly for it? Like a 30-second wrap-up. Why is this a bad idea?
Why is this a bad idea? Well, it's a risky scheme. It puts at risk public safety, public revenue, 5,000 jobs in a time when the job market isn't good. The offer he's given to those people that are going to lose their jobs, at least the 3,500 USCW members, is 2 years tuition assistance at like $1,500 or $1,000 tax credit to somebody who hires you,
nice,
probably at minimum wage. I mean, what kind of to the hardworking people that I know that have been doing this job and going to work and doing a good job every day for years, $1,500 tuition assistance, that doesn't buy your books. Yeah. I mean, I hope when we throw these guys out of office, we can offer them the same thing.
We give them what they usually give us, nothing.
They get what they usually get, a big fat pension that is more than the average guy works for.
Yeah, nice golden parachute. Last question. Now, anything in this where you can say, you know, there's a good idea here? Is there any good to this?
Any good to this?
Yep.
Not for the average working people, not for the average consumer. Maybe for people on one end of the spectrum, especially somebody who could get one of the wholesale licenses, those would be golden. Yeah, it might be good for them, but for the average person, nothing good in this bill, nothing what you expect to see from privatization, that you're going to be able to go to mom-and-pop shop for some wine you never had before that you heard about in a book, and he's going to be able to order it. No, unless one of the Pennsylvania wholesalers has it, you're not going to be able to order it.
Yeah, well, one percenters win, the rest of us lose. John Zudkovich, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, and keep up the fight.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there. Or if you've got the smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So the Borowitz is reporting GOP presidential frontrunner Newt Gingrich today vowed that his days of infidelity were behind him. He told a crowd in Iowa, you know, look, I've screwed all the women I want. All that's left is America. Mr. Gingrich added that as president, I will be 100% faithful to the United States of America. Unless, of course, it gets cancer or something. He also scoffed at rival Mitt Romney's attempt to portray himself as a happily married family man. Newt said, the only reason Mitt hasn't had any sexual scandals is he keeps changing positions. So there you go. The Borowitz Report. Michelle Bachmann, whom I love. I cannot wait until we go to New Hampshire, hoping for the opportunity to interview the crazy one herself. But she was at a stop in Iowa yesterday, or earlier, actually, I guess earlier this morning. And this girl asked her, who is the president of the High School Gay and Lesbian Straight Alliance or whatever it is. And she said, you know, why can't same-sex couples get married? And Michelle Bachmann said, they can get married. They can marry a man if they're a woman, or they can marry a woman if they're a man. kind of missing the whole point here. So she goes, you know, why can't a man marry a man? And Bachmann goes, because that's not the law of the land. They have the same opportunity under the law. There is no right to same-sex marriage, she said. She also said, because Schmidt and this woman asked, why don't you support the LGBT community? And she says, no, I just think that there should be no special rights for people based on their sexual practices. And I heard that, and I'm going, you know, beyond the funny ha-ha, behind the, yeah, gay people can marry as long as they marry someone of the opposite sex, kind of just making you go, I'm not getting it here. Beyond that funny ha-ha, her saying that, you know, people have no special rights based on their sexual preferences, I believe is plain flat wrong. If a man prefers a woman instead of a man, I think there is a preference, right? Because you have the ability to marry. Am I missing something here?
You're accurate.
And I'm not surprised that Michelle Bachmann, in her twisted view of the world, would think this. Maybe she sees them as, you know, potential clients for her husband's twisted little business. I don't know. But she is just nuts. Now, the other side of this is, you know, she said that, you know, one man, one woman is law of the land. It's not. You know, places like Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Vermont, D.C., those places, they do recognize same-sex marriage. So, again, another Fruit Loop moment from Michelle Bachmann, who, again, another one of these Fruit Loop moments today told an audience that if she were president, we wouldn't have an embassy in Iran. Go ahead, give the punchline.
It's only been closed for 30 years.
Yeah, I mean...
Hello?
Yeah, I think I was in 7th or 8th grade when they closed that.
But her staff tried to finesse it and say that, well, she was talking in I think they described it as phonetic terms, not what exactly... In other words, they were trying to make excuse for her huge guffaw and act like, well, she knew that. No, I don't think she knew that. In fact, it was national news, Rick, and the commentator. I never heard that. I mean, they skirted around the issue. They said, well, she's just a flat-out airhead. I never heard them say that, although I tend to agree with them.
Well, we'll use the airhead frame because I like it. It's not bad. Beyond crazy and twisted. Airhead seems to flip. she today, you know, decided who she was going to have her vice presidential candidates, who the VP was going to be when she, her and her 1% polling numbers, when she's up at the top, if she ever makes it.
There must be thousands waiting in line.
Yeah, I mean, she's chosen her VPs, going to narrow it down to Donald Trump, the TV host, Jim DeMint from South Carolina, Marco Rubio from Florida, who's already said he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be VP, but she said he's my guy. And this is the one that just grabbed me, and the reason I brought it up. She has decided that Rick Santorum would be a good vice presidential candidate. And I'm sitting there going, how arrogant, how ditzy, how dim-witted can you be, and how really kind of
condescending.
Yeah, I mean, isn't he running for the same, and aren't you polling about the same all the way down near where they, you know, they dropped the waist? But I just thought it was great that I like Rick Santorum would be a good be. There you go. So instead of Palin Santorum 2012, which we've got to get rid of that stinger, because Palin never jumped in, maybe Bachman Santorum would be next. Because now that the Herman Cain train's kind of derailed, you got to wonder who the next fun one's going to be, because I guess from what Herman said, the whole idea, the whole decision to move forward is, well, his wife's decision, because they haven't had a face-to-face moment yet. Which I guess, you know, I guess is that moment where he goes, how much of my stuff am I going to lose when other affairs come out?
He claims that she's, once he explained the situation with this latest revelation, that she's okay with it.
Yeah,
at least
sure
that's
is.
What he says.
Yeah. What she's okay with? She's okay with going, I don't want to be broke. That's what she's okay with. Because look, and you know, I thought about this earlier. I would have respected Herman if he would have come out and said, look, you know, the two women who came out and accused me of sexual harassment, you know, we went out to dinner, you know, we had a couple of drinks, you know, it was, you know, it wasn't a work-related thing because it wasn't, with the one, that, you know, we kind of flirted around a bit. You know, she kind of led me on to believe that, you know, maybe there'd be something. So we went somewhere. I made a pass. She rejected it, and it ended right there. You know, I'm a man. She's a woman. Thought, hey, you know, this could happen. I always said there's no harassment. But, yeah, I did it. Instead of saying, no, I never did, I'm tired of the people who say no. I know it's a male reactive thing. I get that. Because, you know, I'd like to believe that I would say, no, you busted me. I'm going that route. Because you must know. But with this woman with the 13-year affair, he had to know well before he ran, which leads me to believe that he ran only, as I said before, as a book promotion and as a job interview. I mean, because he wants the Fox gig. He wants to do the radio gig. He wants to do the TV gig. He wants to be the star. He doesn't want to govern. He doesn't know how to govern. But here you go. So I'm excited to see where the Herman Cain train. I'm so hoping he stays in, though, because he's just comic gold.
I mean, this man, he's kind of like the old-time carnival barkers, Rick, have this elixir that will satisfy any disease and any known ailment known to man, and his elixir is 999.
How's that again?
999.
Is that
999?
999.
Oh, I'm trying to be cute here. Oh, you know. Okay?
Yeah. Good luck on that.
No, I mean, seriously, they ask him about foreign policy, and his answer is 999.
And his answer is crickets.
He's trying to be cute. In other words, he doesn't know what to say, so he tries to be cute.
Well, you ask him a question about foreign policy, you get crickets. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking with David Dayan. He is a writer over at Fire Dog Lake. Martha Coakley may be redeeming herself. We will find out when we get back. Stick around. Drowning in crap and lies. Save the USA, every sooner time is mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A massive public worker strike in the United Kingdom Wednesday was about resistance to attacks on the economic and social advances made by working people in the UK over the last 65 years. Protecting pensions was the main issue in the day of action. Lynn McCluskey heads Unite, the UK's largest labour union.
Our members throughout the public service sector are infuriated by the fact that the government have launched this ideological attack on their work, their pensions, their jobs, but also within the private sector itself. The users of public services are angry that everything that has held our nations together for the past 65 years is under threat, and that's why we have to stand up and be counted.
In Olympia, state police have arrested at least 15 people who were occupying Washington's state capitol to protest some $2 billion in budget cuts. Protesters want the state budget balanced without cuts to social services, health care, and schools. Unions have joined with community groups for protest rallies against the austerity cuts that will hurt working and poor people. Andrea Bauer is with a community group called Sisters Organized for Solidarity.
In the daytime, there'll be rallies and protests every day called by different groups and unions, and on Saturday a big mass rally called primarily by the unions. But we will keep going back and we will keep attempting to stay, and we have a protest campaign going to call the governor. So we are not giving up. It's way too important to give up.
American Crystal sugar workers remain locked out, and the company's CEO isn't doing much to win over his employees. Jesse Russell reports.
American Crystal Sugar President and CEO Dave Berg was recorded at a shareholders meeting comparing the employee contract to a cancerous tumor that had to be removed. The website Workday Minnesota has posted the audio.
Can't let the labor contract make us sick forever and ever and ever. We have to treat the disease, and that's what we're doing here.
1,300 employees have been locked out since August 1st in Minnesota and North Dakota. There has been little movement in reaching a new contract agreement. Berg explained to the shareholders that the lockout was part of a long-term strategy that would be expensive in the present, but profitable for the shareholders in the future. He went on to specifically apply the tumor analogy to workers seeking to keep health care benefits in their contract.
Keep the health benefit, give them a 2% wage increase, and don't change anything else. I know that because I negotiated the last two contracts. At some point, that tumor's got to come out.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The men who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So you remember yesterday we talked about the 103-year-old woman that douchebag wanted to pitch out into the streets, and the sheriff showed up and the movers showed up, and they looked at each other and they go, there's just no way we can throw a 103-year-old woman out in the street along with her 83-year-old daughter. So today you find out that Chase Bank, the people who, I guess, service the loan for douchebag, they have now said that they do not have any plans to evict her. In fact, they're going to try and work out some arrangement. This could be one of those messaging nightmares. Personally, I'd like to see the paperwork, much like Marcy Kaptur says, show me the note. Because we've also seen a number of other stories of, well, people getting screwed over, especially soldiers. That's why I'm encouraged that Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley, hopefully she can redeem herself after that 2010 debacle. She has filed suit today against Bank of America Corp., Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citi, and Ally Financial. In addition to that, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems Incorporated was named as well, Mears Corp., listed as defendants. So good. So here to talk about the Coakley situation is David Dayton. He is a writer over at FireDogLake.com. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me on the show, Rick.
you know, I look at this and I'm, there's part of me that goes, okay, Martha, now you may have the opportunity to redeem yourself a little bit. I'm happy to see this.
Yeah, I think this does redeem her as a public servant anyway, acting on behalf of her constituents. She is the first person who has brought a lawsuit against the banks over foreclosure fraud. We've had Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada do a criminal lawsuit against some of the mid-level employees that were executing the robo-signing. We've had Bo Biden suing MERS Corp. And that's part of this lawsuit as well. But this is the first one that actually goes after the banks. And sometimes we get too complicated about this, but what the lawsuit is saying that the banks are stealing home. I mean, if you want to put it in the most simplest terms that possible, she's saying that there is case law in Massachusetts that says if you can't have, if you don't have the legal justification to prove ownership, then you can't foreclose on somebody. And without this legal justification, the banks are still foreclosing, and that is theft.
Basically. Well, hasn't that been the whole robo-signing thing, this entire the whole thing? I mean, the reason Marcy Kaptur, the Democrat from the 9th Congressional District in Ohio, she's been saying, don't leave your house until they show you the note and they actually have the paperwork.
Absolutely. It's the exact same thing. I mean, there's almost two prongs here. Robo-signing is almost the cover-up to the major crime. And the major crime is that in the securitization process, when during the housing bubble, these banks sliced and diced these mortgages, transferred them, used this private registry, MERS, to transfer these mortgages together and move them all around, they did not go through the proper steps to keep the chain of title clear. So we don't know who owns these homes. And robo-signing was put in after the fact as a way to sort of get around this. You know, it was a way to sort of pretend ownership, and you put these fraudulent documents out there to the court, and the court accepts them, and we move on. Well, that hasn't happened in Massachusetts. There are Supreme Court rulings, particularly the Ibanez case, which state very clearly that if you can't prove the ownership of the loan, you do not have standing to foreclose. So,
yeah, I mean,
so Massachusetts is really the best place to bring this kind of lawsuit.
Well, why is that? Because I think they have some pretty strong consumer protection.
That's that too as well. But, I mean, you have this case law that has gone through the Massachusetts Supreme Court,
okay,
has been affirmed on a number of occasions that says, you know, what I said about the standing to foreclose. And so because you have that case law there, the law is very clear. And so when you have these violations, and Coakley in the complaint lists a number of real-world incidents where the banks did not have standing, you know, when you have all of this in place and you have the case law that is so clear, it's a much easier case to bring because of all those underlying factors.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, I my mind just popped into something a couple of months back, where the Obama administration was, and this is probably not good in his, not a good light on him, but they were trying to work out some kind of deal to where this whole MERS problem would go away, and they would, you know, they would be able to go and start foreclosing on people, because at some point people are going to get these houses, you're going to have to foreclose on them.
Right. You're talking about the 50-state settlement,
right,
which all the state attorneys general and the Obama administration through the Justice Department, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, are trying to do this grand kind of global settlement with the banks over these issues, over robo-signing, which would give a great deal of liability release to the banks in exchange for some manner of, I think the number is $25 billion. Many Democratic attorney generals have been pulling off of this, saying this is not enough. We haven't done an investigation. We haven't taken the time to see the depth of this problem. And if you don't know how deep the problem goes, how can you settle? how do you know what the proper number is to put on this if you haven't done the investigation? So here we have an attorney general in Massachusetts who had done the investigation. Remember, this has been going on for over a year. The 50-state investigation, quote-unquote investigation, where they jump right to the settlement, started a year ago. And there's still nothing on the part of the banks. And Coakley said in her press conference that a key reason why she brought this lawsuit is that she's been in those rooms working on this settlement, and the banks have been unwilling to give the proper amount of restitution, and they've been very willing to want to take as much liability release as possible, not just over robo-signing, but over almost the entire breadth of issues surrounding this foreclosure and mortgage nightmare. So, you know, this is what you do when you're faced with a negotiation and you have the banks who are resistant to, you know, owning up. You take them to court. I mean, this is how you get something done. You play hardball. You don't just settle. You don't just telegraph that you're going to settle and then try to work out a price.
And at the end of it, what I'm afraid of is I'm going to end up getting stuck holding the bag, bailing out the big bankers, while the people at the bottom are going to be the ones suffering as well. As you know, what I said from the very beginning when this whole thing started back in 2008, when the collapse happened, as I said from the beginning, make the people at the bottom whole. Bail them out first, and it'll work its way back up, and that's how you save the banks, by saving the people at the bottom.
Right, and that's not what we've seen. I mean, we heard this week that the Federal Reserve lent out $7 trillion in emergency lending to the banks. And you know, it's the classic situation of the banks got bailed out and we all got left out. There has been nowhere near the urgency on the foreclosure crisis or the jobs crisis as what was put to the financial crisis in 2008. And this is an example of trying to get that accountability and justice back. And it's not just Coakley. I mean, as I've mentioned, the AGs in Nevada and Delaware and Eric Schneiderman in New York has been doing a great job, and California's Kamala Harris. So there is this stirring of justice Democrats who are trying to get some real accountability on this issue.
As I remember, it was Schneiderman from New York who kind of brought to light that this deal was going on, and the fix was almost in, if I remember right.
Yeah, I mean, his break from the deal was a major factor, and then, of course, he was unceremoniously dumped from the executive committee that was doing the negotiating. And he was clear. He was in those rooms. He saw that the banks were trying to get away scot-free with a slap on the wrist and without any investigation, which is the biggest problem here, that how do you settle when you don't know what's going on? And so this lawsuit by Coakley is an attempt to, you know, get to the problem, because obviously there's going to be a discovery phase, and there's going to be, you know, this is the result of an investigation that will only continue.
And I can't wait to see what goes on with this. And speaking of investigations, yesterday, speaking of Schneiderman as well, he evidently launched an investigation into looking into the 5,000 military families who were possibly illegally foreclosed upon.
Yeah, I mean, this is a violation of federal law, the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which very clearly says you cannot foreclose on a member of active duty military while they're serving overseas. And the banks did this. I mean, they've admitted to it. They've done settlements where they've given extreme amounts of money. I call it camo washing, because they're, you know, trying to boost their public image by going out of their way. I mean, they've given something like $117,000 per wrongful foreclosure in the case of Bank of America. But this is a violation of the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which carries a year in prison. I mean, it's right in the statute. And what Schneiderman is doing is, because the Justice Department has sort of facilitated settlements, but they haven't acted on the criminal side at all, he's using his state's consumer protection law, the Martin Act, which is very powerful, to undergo an investigation of whether these consumer protection laws were violated in the state of New York, in addition to this violation of federal law. And I think it's a good thing to do. I mean, it's maybe the most egregious part of this whole thing is that they're foreclosing on people while they're serving our country, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever. They come home to see that they've been, you know, had their home repossessed. I don't think it gets any worse than that.
Yeah, I can't imagine anything worse than that. And I'm sure you get the letter from home going, hey, you know, we're not living on the street corner. What should we be doing?
Exactly. You have your family who's at home worried enough about, you know, whether you're going to make it back in one piece. And you get the call saying, yeah, by the way, we're going into an eviction state. I mean, that's the whole reason for the Service Member Civil Relief Act. It says, essentially, that when you're overseas, concentrate on the job at hand, the battle at hand, and not concentrate on whether you're going to still have a house when you get back.
It just goes to show that these criminals, they have no conscience. They have no allegiance to this country whatsoever.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've got a friend who's a CEO of a credit union, pretty good-sized credit union here in the state of Pennsylvania. And he said, you know, we've got to hold these people to a much higher standard than anyone else because we've given them such a lofty status and they need to be held accountable. And I'm kind of encouraged by Coakley and Snyderman and some of the other things. But in the coming weeks and months, what should we be looking at? What should we be looking for to see if this is
right.
If this is real or if this is just political gamesmanship?
Obviously, we're going to see these lawsuits play out, the one in Nevada, the one in Delaware, the one now in Massachusetts. There are ongoing investigations in New York and California. And, you know, the pressure needs to continue on these guys. I mean, they've done a great job so far, but we don't necessarily want it to fall back and have them rejoin this lingering settlement, which who knows if that's ever going to happen with all these states dropping out. But, you know, the investigations right now I think are in a good place, but they need to be followed through upon. And hopefully more attorneys general will get the message that this is, you know, what you do when you're a public servant. You serve your constituents by, you know, upholding the law. So hopefully these five Democrats or six Democrats, these attorneys general will be joined by a lot more attorneys general who will investigate these crimes.
That is the hope. The piece is inside the Coakley foreclosure fraud lawsuit written by David Dayan over at FireDogLake.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on David's name. It'll take you right there. Dave, great talking to you. I appreciate it. Would love to have you back again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith.
We're out today with Mike, veteran, volunteer, and adventurer.
I tell a lot of people I'm a gray-haired teenager, because I act like one.
Mike loves life, and Capital Blue Cross helps him live it to the fullest, so he's a big fan.
I'm a Senior Blue PPO member. I have recommended Capital Blue Cross to 27 Medicare beneficiaries this year alone.
Mike must really care about his friends.
Capital Blue Cross has made the Medicare process easier, and they're very sincere, and they want to help you.
Mike, we've got you covered.
The bottom line is, if you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 888-340-3978. That's 888-340-3978. Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Accountability, there's a word that the right loves to throw around. They just love it. We need to hold people accountable. We need transparency. We need open government. Yet when you see what they're actually doing, it's everything but that. You look here in the state of Pennsylvania, open, accountable, really? Transparent? You kidding? No, not so much. And you look at this whole thing, and thank goodness for Martha Coakley and Snyderman and all these other people who are trying to, at least trying. This is another knock against the Obama administration. And look, Republicans would have already done it by now. So don't go saying, well, this is why we need Mitt or one of the other idiots. No. The fix was in until these people said no. And I'm happy to see that. And talking about Martha Coakley, I mean, the worst campaign probably ever run and up until Herman Cain, that is. But she's kind of redeeming herself. Hopefully, they recapture that seat. Hopefully, the Kennedy seat goes back to a Democrat. And this Elizabeth Warren, who doesn't have the Democratic nomination yet, she's got a 4-point lead over Scott Brown right now. So it's kind of a good sign. I kind of keep pushing that out there. Hopefully this works out well.
And if you noticed, Brown has been. Voting the right way lately. Gee, I wonder why. Do you think because he knows he's in for a tough election?
No, well,
he's got to be a moderate, and within the Republican Party, he's considered a liberal. if you compare his record with the crazies in the right wing, he's really to the left, and he has to be to get elected. He has to be at the very least a moderate.
Well, there you go.
But she's got a good shot at winning that.
I'm hoping so. Anyway, as the polling numbers go one way or another, you see the desperation. And I got a hold of this Rick Perry clip that just kind of made me chuckle. He sounds awful 99-ish. Sounds like he's been spending a couple of nights in the occupation. Listen to this. I mean, it's one of those things that just makes you go, Rick who?
The large banks who were over-leveraged, not the insurance company that took on too much risk, not even the executives who continued to get these huge bonuses even after the walls had crumbled down. No, the people that are paying the price are average Americans, Main Street businesses. It's our children who stand to inherit the worst fiscal mess in the history of this country. It is wrong. It is unfair. It is unjust. We shouldn't be awarding.
Unjust.
We shouldn't be awarding taxpayer-funded bonuses to Wall Street executives who defrauded those very same taxpayers. We ought to be locking them up.
Ought to be locking them up. Right there with you, brother. Sing it. Sing it.
Mr. Speaker, when I'm the President of the United States, we will clean up corruption from K Street to Wall Street so that they cannot gamble with our children's future again.
You listen to that, and he sounds almost like a 99%er, doesn't he? He goes on to say, we're going to, I won't stop until Congress and the American people, they pass a balanced budget amendment, and they do the earmark thing. But up to that point, he sounded like, hey, let's start holding those criminals accountable. And it kind of shows that he's really falling in the polls. The chances of him coming kind of down. But this whole idea of a balanced budget amendment, how exactly? And now listen to the beginning of it, because he got some of the, hey, let's go get the bankers. How does a balanced budget amendment rein in the bankers? How does it stop that? It doesn't. And he wants to rein in the Wall Street types, right? He said that. Got to rein them in, got to make them accountable. Yet he opposes Dodd-Frank. He opposes regulations in general. He's not going to take us back to Glass-Steagall. So how do you rein in Wall Street then? Surely the cowboy understands once the horse is out of the barn, they don't voluntarily come back in. No?
Exactly right. Well, Rick, the truth is he's inconsistent. If it was up to him, according to the what I'm taking from what he's saying, he would allow the economy to you know, just fall to another Great Depression. He would not have funded it. He would not have saved any of the industries. He would not have saved any of the banks. And the problem with him is he's so inconsistent. His answer seems to be less regulation, not more. Less, which just is totally anathema to what he's talking about.
We need to hold him accountable.
How do you hold him accountable with less regulation? Now, he obviously hasn't
the invisible man
explained
will do it.
That.
The invisible man will do it. Anyway, one of the things that gets me, and we mentioned a little bit earlier about Frank Luntz, and I wanted to get a little bit of what he said, because I think you're going to start hearing some of the changing in words, and you need to see them when they're coming, because they're very... The Republicans are very good at staying on message, and usually on Frank Luntz's message. So the Republican Governors Association, they met in Florida this week, and they brought in Luntz, who is, you know, in my estimation, probably an absolute genius when it comes to turning a phrase. Death tax is amazing, because it's really taken on a life of its own, even though you know it's all BS. But it's still great. It's a visceral reaction. It's short. It's to the point. It's amazing. So he was advising these people on, well, you know, what we need to do is, you know, we need to kind of, you know, now we're afraid of it. You know, it's having impact, so we need to really take it on. So he's telling these people not to mention the word capitalism. Don't say capitalism anymore. The public still prefers capitalism to socialism, he said, but they think capitalism is immoral, and it is. There's no emotion. There's no I care about my neighbor. There's none of that. And it's how it's supposed to be. He also says if we're seen as the defenders of quote unquote Wall Street, we've got a problem. And the Republicans are bought and paid for by Wall Street. I don't think you can get away from that. He says you got to empathize with the 99ers. Say, you know, we got to empathize with you. I get it. He said you know, use three words. I get it. I get that you're, you know, whatever. I get that you've seen inequity. I get that you're having problems. And I get that you want to fix the system. And, you know, you focus on fixing the system because, of course, government's broken. I mean, that's the whole point there. Taking this frame, and it's always anti-government. It always comes back to that. It's the government's fault. It's the government's problem. And you're going to start hearing this stuff often. And he also says, don't say the word bonus. No more bonuses. Because we do know that Wall Street is going to, here in the Christmas holiday, they are going to be handing out their billions in bonuses. He says, instead of calling them bonuses, say it's pay for performance. Now, think about this for a second. Think about how this whole pay for performance thing works. Who crashed the economy? In September of 2008, how did we get to the basement? Was it those teachers and public sector workers? Was it the firemen? Was it the people who pick up my trash or make sure my water's clean? Was it any of those people? Did they crash the economy? Well, to hear the Republicans, yes. But any rational, thoughtful person realizes, no, that it wasn't my garbage man or the cop. It was these gamblers, these speculators. It was these criminals on Wall Street who did this because there was nobody watching them. There wasn't a cop on that beat. So he's trying to change that as well. And look, you're going to start hearing that. He also says don't mention the middle class anymore. Evidently, there's no more middle class in Republican world. He says, well, basically, because nobody buys that Republicans give a tinker's damn about the middle class. He's now saying hardworking taxpayers. So get ready, and we should have a drinking game over that. You know, just watch one of the, you know, the fake news on Fox News broadcasts, and how many times they bring up hardworking taxpayers. We should take a shot on. I don't think it would take you too long to get just wrecked. But he's saying no, not the middle class anymore. Hardworking taxpayers. Because again, nobody. I mean, I don't buy that the Republicans care about the middle class. They care about the investor class. And he also says, don't talk about taxing the rich. He says, say that the government is taking from the rich. They're stealing from them. And we're going to start hearing those. Those frames are going to be, get your drinking game ready, Jake, because those are the ones that are going to be front and foremost. So make sure that you've got the tally sheet all ready. Hardworking taxpayers. I mean, isn't that great? I mean, it's really a great frame.
He's excellent. He's doing nuancing to give them an advantage. And if they do it properly, that will actually help their game, unfortunately for us.
Yeah, I look at that. And, you know, because words matter. I mean, you know, the Carlin bit where you talk about what we now call PTSD, which we now we don't even know what that is half the time anymore. You know, he goes back to World War One. He said, you know, they used to call it shell shock. You know, he came back because, you know, you were beaten up in battle. It was shell shock. And you got people to help, and then, you know, comes Korea, then comes battle fatigue. A little softer, a little longer word. And he goes on to, you know, we ended up into Vietnam, which was post-traumatic stress disorder. Then it's, you know, got a syndrome, and now it's just PTSD. It's completely sanitized of its meaning whatsoever. Maybe, and this is what Carlin's premise was, maybe if we were still calling it shell shock, because it would grab people, maybe we'd be getting people the help that they need. And that was his premise years ago. And here we are doing the same kind of thing. So to me, language absolutely matters. The words that you use matter because they have meaning. But where he's changing things, and Luntz is, I wish there was a Democrat who was as good as he is, where he's changing it is he's getting away from the buzz stuff and reframing the discussion because they've got the power to do it.
Well, he might have a problem, though, Rick. Is it too little, too late? I think with some people it already is. With some people that verbiage might work, but I think there's a lot of people who really know that the Republicans, no matter what they say, they look at what they do, and they're firmly convinced, correctly so, that they favor the wealthy. They favor that 1%, and therein lies the problem with the Republicans. Is it too little, too late?
Those are the hardworking taxpayers. I can't. Yeah, I'm telling you, get ready for it. That's all I'm saying. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In response to the Supreme Court's freakish decision in 2010 to bestow political personhood on corporations, I got an email from a guy named Larry screaming that big money has plucked our eagle. Yes, it has. And the powers that be tell us that we shouldn't even try to undo this theft of our people's democratic authority, but instead should just try regulating corporate money, like maybe requiring them to disclose how much they're spending on campaigns. Now there's a bold stand for democracy. Give us campaign finance reporting regulations or give us death. Come on, we're bigger than that. Here are just a few actions for real change that you can take, teaming up with others right where you live. Amend. Two major coalitions are organizing to overturn the court's corporate money edict by amending the Constitution. One is FreeSpeechForPeople.org, and the other is MoveToAmend.org. And both have action kits for raising the issue locally, petitions to be circulated, video and other good graphics to educate people, and a wealth of other organizing ideas. Localize. Pass your own local and state laws to stop the wholesale corporate purchase of our government. These include outlawing any corporate claim of personhood in your area, providing the alternative of public financing for your local and state elections, and banning campaign donations by corporations that try to get government contracts and subsidies. For information and help, check out publiccampaign.org and reclaimdemocracy.org. Confront. Yes, get in the face of power. Ask all candidates where they stand on corporate personhood and demand that top executives of big corporations located in your area publicly agree not to spend corporate cash on your elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, the Constitution plainly says we the people, not we the corporations.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Put your hands in to the big sky.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. This evening we went to a holiday party. And you listen to the Hightower commentary there, and he's talking about the people over at Move to Amend. And we actually met a couple at the party who they're actually involved with Move to Amend. In fact, in the Carlisle area, they're planning to have a party here in the coming weeks and months, I guess, to try and organize a Move to Amend chapter locally here in the listening area. And I give them all the credit in the world, and whatever we can do to help here at the program, we will. But it's just kind of ironic that you hear that during the Hightower minute, and I just had the conversation with these people. Pretty amazing. And again, if you want more information, movetoamend.org. It's all about the Citizens United thing and taking our elections back. You look at all the money that's perverted our electoral process, and it's just an absolute crime. So there you go. Got an email during the break, Jake, and I promised myself I wasn't going to laugh, but she wants to know about the Muppet on the show named Jake. She was curious what color your Muppet costume was and if you were going to be featured in the latest Muppet movie.
We're working on it.
Working on it? Do you have a Muppet name? Because I was thinking Mopser. Because you like to say you're the big bopper or mopper. I like mopper.
That sounds good.
Is mopper good?
I mean, maybe we could have a contest.
There you go. That's it. We'll have a contest. Name the Muppet name. I like it. Put that on the Facebook page. We need to name our Muppet.
There you go.
Also says, hey, thanks for sticking up for the 99% and tell your Governor Tom Corporate to end the war on workers. Thanks, Sarah. I appreciate the email. And now we have a contest to name the Muppet. So what's on Sesame Street tonight, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. You talked earlier about the Republicans' ability to strike down some progressive legislation that would have made it easier for unions to get a yes vote on a union election. I think it's appropriate that when some Republicans cross the line, and in today's environment, that's dangerous. There were about seven Republicans who crossed. There were eight Republicans who crossed the line. And here's the irony, Rick. All eight of them were from heavily unionized states, except the congressman from Alaska.
Crossed the line. Well, no, Alaska's a pretty high-density state.
But it's not a heavily unionized state.
Yes, it is. They crossed the line. No, they came from the dark side. They came into the light.
They came into the light. Let's put it to you this way. They went against their party's, general feeling on the subject. I think kudos are necessary. Congressman Grimm from New York, Peter King, who's been in the news, and he's not always a friend of ours from New York, Stephen LaTourette from Ohio, Chris Smith from New Jersey, John Runyon, a former professional football player.
Tea Party guy.
He voted. He voted on the right side. Frank Labando from New Jersey, Timothy Johnson from Illinois, and Don Young from Alaska. Now, six Democrats voted the wrong way. All six, not surprisingly, come from southern right-to-work states. Shame on them, but it doesn't surprise me that those votes came from southern right-to-work states.
So just so I get this right, because I'm just trying to make sure I got your concept right. Don Young from Alaska, that surprises you?
It surprises me.
I mean, I'm asking you, does that surprise you?
I'm surprised that there are Republicans in this environment that have the guts to vote with labor unions.
You do realize that Alaska has a 25% unionization density rate, the second highest in the nation.
Is that right?
Yeah. New York has the highest.
Actually, that is surprising.
Yeah.
Okay, I withdraw that.
That's just from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
So it actually does make sense from a purely
Yep, I just wanted to help
political,
you.
Well, I stand amended on that one. World AIDS Day was held recently. The International Trade Union Confederation was renewing its efforts in the workplace to focus on and promote action on AIDS and HIV. Communication workers, local unions continue to raise funds from the Elizabeth Glass Pediatric AIDS Foundation. So far, done a great job. They've raised over $7 million. CWA has focused on the fund since 1990 when Elizabeth Glasser spoke at the CWA National Convention about the devastating effects of pediatric AIDS. She knew from personal experience she had contracted HIV from a blood transfusion during childbirth in 1981 and unknowingly passed the disease on to both her children. 30 years ago, the first case of AIDS was identified. Today, nearly 34 million people live with HIV worldwide. More than 7,000 new infections occur every day. The nationwide economic downturn has hampered those efforts to prevent the new infections and to help people live with HIV and AIDS. Kudos to the CWA and the ITUC for their efforts on behalf of fighting AIDS. They are to be congratulated for their noble efforts. The story that doesn't stop, the Penn State story, we've been reporting on that off and on now for, well, what is it, 3 weeks now. There's an organization called the Pennsylvania Sex Abuse Crime Victims Law Center. It's set up by lawyers who are basically looking for clients, and they have found a treasure trove is exactly right, very well put. And they have put out in their website who they think are the most at risk. Now, of course, number one, you would guess right. Mr. Sandusky is first. His charity, the Second Mile, second, and Penn State is third. But also on the list, I'm not so sure this is in the right order. They have Joe Paterno, and they have Clinton County High School, where Sandusky allegedly had contact with the victim. I think eventually you're going to see lawsuits against Spanier. This is just me. They also asked you, do you agree with that list? Not necessarily, not totally. I think those people that were mentioned will be sued, but I think there's going to be more. I think the president of the university will be sued, and so will Curley and Schultz. In fact, Curley and Schultz faced some stiff prison terms. They were indicted by the grand jury for perjury.
Again, stiff, the right word there? It's two nights in a row.
You know, use the adjective you want. They face some prison term.
As they should.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we shall see exactly what comes out of that. Now, we're talking about the Liquor Control Board and the efforts to privatize it. House Bill 11. I don't think a lot of people quite understand how bad it is. Let me quick run over it. House Bill 11 would dismantle both the retail and the wholesale operations of the PLCB, eliminating right up front about 4,000 jobs. It would be putting, in the big picture, about 5,000 PLC jobs at risk. Would raise taxes and prices on most brands of wines and spirits sold in the state liquor control shops by as much as 35%, according to the experts who have studied it. They want to at least double the number of retail liquor outlets in Pennsylvania, increasing the risk for more impaired driving and underage and irresponsible drinking. I would hope, I sincerely mean this, I would hope for the welfare of the children, for the welfare of the state, that this is defeated. And right now, this is not a done deal.
Personally, I think it's going to go through.
Well, from what I'm hearing, there's some key votes in the Republican side.
I
know we talked
seen,
about some people that we thought would be involved, like the church.
Yeah, I haven't seen
mothers.
The churches, and I haven't seen the usual people who are the ones who are generally against this out in force.
The problem is the Republicans have. There's some opposition from the other side. And like I said, I know there's at least one senator who's opposed to it because he's getting pressure from the businessmen who own, beer distributorships. They're saying as it's constructed now, they're opposed to it. So it'll be interesting. And I really do hope that it's turned down once. And you're exactly right when you say once they eliminate it, it's eliminated. You're not going to come back.
Yeah, I mean, there's no going
back. Once you cross the Rubicon, there's no going back.
You know, once you sell that asset off, there's no getting it back. I mean, you know, there's some people who say, well, let's give it a let's try it. Well, once you start down that path, there's no U-turn. There's no driveway to turn around. You're going down that road.
Here's the basic opposition I have. I hear this constant argument, and I hear this on talk shows. I hear this from the politicians who want to change it. Government shouldn't be involved. Well, you know what? The people of Pennsylvania decided that in 1970, and it's worked. And your changes are really a solution in search of a problem. Where's the problem with the present system? There's so many positives. And at the end of the day, it comes down to the big profits, and there's people that have political influence that want to get their hands on it. It's that simple.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the reality is it's about the money. I mean, there's so much to it that we're not going to get. I mean, just stop and think about the simple stuff. We get $100 million a year pure profit. That goes away immediately. All the tax money that we get in, we don't have to pay auditors, and we don't have to pay a whole bunch of people to make sure it's collected. It's collected. It's paid because we do it. The 1% that we pay out for people who pay their taxes on time, like the big box retailers who get that 1% break, and you know all of them who pay their taxes on time, like the rest of us do, they get a 1% break. The wine and spirit shops, they don't get that break. They pay every penny of taxes. Now, right from the start, you're losing a whole percent of tax going into the coffers. It doesn't make any sense to me on any level. But then again, this isn't about money for them, I don't believe. It's about their blind faith, bizarre ideology.
Well, to show you how successful it is, Rick, I don't know if you know this, but the revenue from wine and spirits generates more money than any other state except Texas. That shows you how successful it is. And by the way, it has the lowest alcohol-related morbidity rates, which you know are going to go up under a privatized system.
Well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's how you thin the herd.
Well, you're being facetious, but in the end, I mean, the truth is, you're going to have more alcohol-related deaths, sadly. And you're going to have innocent people die. And that was a great argument the last time this was tried, the great battle in the 90s. The Mad Mothers were out there in force, and they were very, very effective politically. And I don't see them there now.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe
but the issue hasn't gone away.
The whole dead thing. I mean, that's a pro-growth, pro-business... Because there's an industry that could profit from that. I don't know. We got to think this through. Let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
America. Rick Smith.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations and industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant because they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican.
Yeah, but don't hug them too close because they may think you're gay. And if you're, as Michelle Bachmann said, you know, gay people can marry each other as long as a man marries a woman and a gay man marries a gay woman and a gay woman marries a gay man. That, perfect. You know, kind of. And I've always wondered about that. Would that work? I don't know. Maybe send me an email on it, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Good news today, Tom Harkin. From the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. He is the chairman there. He vowed today to prohibit Congress from going home unless they pass an extension of unemployment. And good for him. It's about time. Maybe this should have been something he thought of doing last year. Maybe, just a thought, when the hostage situation happened last year, and you'll remember after the November election last year when the Republicans took over in the future. Basically, the Democrats just caved. Yeah, okay, we'll extend your Bush handouts. Oh, but please give us a little bit of unemployment. Now, remember, they extended the Bush handouts until next year. So the 1% taken care of until next year. The people who are down on their luck, the people who are struggling to get by, people who are unemployed, well, tough luck. It's only good until the end of this year. And what I'm saying is, and I'm hoping Harkin keeps to his word, no Christmas until you pass an extension. Coal in your stockings. I'm hoping Santa brings all these Republicans coal in their stockings. Now, the Republicans are going to fight, kick, and scratch because, oh, you know, they're lazy people, and you know, all these lazy workers. I still got to check the 50,000 people claim. 140 jobs down in South Carolina and 50,000 people apply for it. That is just, what do you say? I mean, really, how bad is it? But then again, South Carolina has what? A little over 11% unemployment? And again, I go back to that whole argument that the right tries to make that, well, what we need to have is we need Pennsylvania to be a right to work state so we can enjoy that, the benefits of places like South Carolina, places like Alabama and Georgia. Good, solid. Well, wait a minute. Hold on. High unemployment, low wages, no benefits, no pensions. Is that a good thing? And the answer is no, it's not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. But it is the holiday season. And with it being the holiday season, you're going to get dumb people doing dumb things. So when I saw this story of the guy who evidently locked himself out of his house, well, he decided that, well, maybe it'd be a good idea if, yeah, he did it. He climbed down the chimney and he got stuck. It works for Santa Claus. It works for Santa Claus. No, he said he wanted to get in the house without tearing the house up. He said that was the best idea he could come up with. And let's say it just didn't work out real well because once he got down the chimney, oops, now you got to start tearing it apart. So I'm guessing that the next time he locks his keys in the house, he's either going to call his wife and tell her to bring him a set, or he's just going to maybe break a window or kick in the door, not try and slide down the chimney. Exactly. I wonder how that thought process works. Gee, you know, I wonder if he looks like Santa Claus. And he goes, you know, if Santa Claus can do it, because he's a jolly old fella, he can fit down the chimney, why can't I? So there you go, our stupid moment of the day.
I thought you were going to say, and it wouldn't be the first time he locked himself out and he didn't have any clothes on. Wouldn't be the first time.
That would have been better yet. And then he tried to slide down the chimney. When I first started reading the story, I was kind of hoping, and it just tells you how sick I am sometimes, I was hoping that his wife had lit a fire underneath. But no, that didn't happen. So I'm guessing, and you're the big sports fan, the NBA lockout coming to an end, right?
Yes.
They've come to a sort of an agreement. Things are going to start moving forward. A little problem for a couple of players who have this Wilson Chandler, Kenyon Martin, J.R. Smith, and Aaron Brooks. Evidently four very good players, top players in the NBA. Well, they gambled, rolled the dice. Thought the season would be lost, so they went to China. They went to China and signed up with the Chinese Basketball Association, who have told them, sorry, folks, you're not getting out of your contract. You are going to play the entire season for us, or you are not going to get paid, and we are not going to release you to leave the country or give you the ability to then sign with the NBA.
And I wonder if they, in China, I think I know the answer, but I'm going to answer it. Does the government have a right to keep them there?
Well, it all depends on their visa. You know, they've signed a contract.
Oops.
You know, their contract enforcement's a little different than it is here.
Yes.
But like the guy who's the head of the Chinese Basketball Association said, they can play, get paid, and return to the NBA in March, or they can not get paid and return to the NBA in March. It's up to them, but they're not leaving until March.
And they can eat all the sweet and sour they want.
Well, you know, hey. Now, here's the weird part. There's a couple of Chinese players who had played in the Chinese Basketball League. They're going to be able to leave. And a part of it also has to do with how the NBA classified people as free agents. These folks were not under contract, so there's a weird little agreement between the two leagues. So these four, well, good for them.
Well, I do believe the interest in the NBA has waned, to be quite frank about it.
Yeah, I mean,
I wouldn't have cared if they didn't play all year, to be honest.
Yeah, I saw GQ had a list of the least influential people in the country. I don't know if you saw this, but Ed Schultz was number three on the list of the least influential people. I would have to think the NBA would be number two, because you know they got locked out and the fear of no season. And there's part of me thought nobody cared. So there you go. I begin my basketball coaching career this Saturday. My daughter's my fourth grade daughter's first game this Saturday. I've been doing a little practicing, hoping we're ready. Hoping, but there's part of me that says nope. Sorry, we're not. Not there yet. I'm hoping not to lose like these middle school kids in Kentucky. Pikeville Independent Middle School played Kemper Elementary and Middle School, and well, it was 100-2. At halftime, it was 70-0, and I'm going, what do you do? You're losing 70-0 at the half. Do you come out in the second half? 100-2 they lost. I guess you could make the argument they only lost 30-2 in the second half.
This is high school?
No, it's elementary. They're eighth grade students. So there you go. Anyway, I want to thank everybody who listened to the program. Our guests are, of course, Brett, our chief knob turner over there, and the guy who answers the phone. He keeps everything going. And, of course, thank you. If you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, best place to get it. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Until tomorrow, have a great night. We'll be right back here.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming. Too late. Yes, hey.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.